to that name? Thank you. Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to Wednesday, April 13th, AA board meeting. I'd like to call the meeting to order, and I'd like to ask Brenda to do a roll call of the board members, please.
Thank you. Commissioner Sandy?
Yes, I'm on.
Mr. Ellis?
Here.
Mr. Kindig?
Here.
Mr. Fogel?
Here.
Mr. Dieselmore?
Here.
Mr. Mitchell?
Here.
Chair Pruitt?
We're here.
All are present.
Thank you. Next up is item number 3, our agenda approval. Has everybody had a chance to take a look at it? And Alan, any changes?
No changes at this time.
All right, thank you. I'll entertain a motion.
This is Bill Kendrick. I'd like to move the agenda as presented.
This is Albert. I'll second.
Is there any objection to adopting the agenda today? Hearing and seeing none, the agenda is approved. Brings us to item number 4, prior minutes for March 2nd, 2022. Hopefully everybody had a chance to review the minutes. And for those that make comments or in the minutes, is there any deletions, corrections, clarifications that board members would like to give?
Mr. Chairman, I would like the motion that we approve the prior meeting minutes of March 2nd as presented. This is Albert.
Thank you, Albert.
This is Bill Kendrick. I second.
Thank you, Bill. Is there any objection to adopting the March 2nd, 2022 minutes? Hearing and seeing none, they are adopted. Bring us to item number 5, public comments. 2 minutes per person, please. And we ask that you state your name and your affiliation, and that you speak to any topic that's on the agenda today. With that, is there anybody in the boardroom wishing to make a comment? Seeing none. Is anybody online, Amy?
Good morning, it's Ken Kastner again from Homer. I wanted to talk about the executive session that you have coming up. In it, you disclose for the first time to the public that that we are engaged in a lawsuit over violations of the Open Meetings Act. That's the nature of the lawsuit. And we're in the 16th month of that, and this will probably drag on for a while longer. I was deposed last week by an assistant attorney general who was very curious as to what my background in Open Meetings Act knowledge was, and wanted to know if I had filed records requests for the information regarding capacity and collateral of these loans that you make, which are mandated by the Open Meetings Act to be disclosed to the public. I have not made any records requests to get things that I think should have been disclosed automatically because they're required to be disclosed. And that's about the sum of it all. I wouldn't recommend taking on a state agency for declaratory relief because it's not an easy process. And it is very, very protracted. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further? You might want to give them the information on how to get to make sure that they could put the razor in to get.
Provide a little comment if you want to. When you call in, pardon me. When you call in to enter the telephone conference, we will ask callers to put *9 on their phone if you wish to make a comment. This will initiate a hand-raising function. We will unmute callers individually in the order they were received. When an individual is unmuted, you will hear, "It is now your turn to speak." Please identify yourself when making a comment.
Not much one, but yeah. So is there anybody online now? Rainy?
There is no other public comments at this time.
Okay. Well, if there's none other, we will close the public comment session. brings us to item number six, new business, loan participation portfolio, risk management policy.
To the chair, with agenda item 6A, we have the loan participation portfolio risk management policy memorandum. The memorandum and attachments were attached and linked to the agenda, so they're also made available to the public. This is a follow-on discussion from what we've had in several budget and audit subcommittee meetings, and most recently being the meeting this March, where this memorandum was reviewed by the budget and audit subcommittee and recommended ultimately for full review by the board. So I would highlight that the chair of that committee, Albert Fogel, was also able to address some questions that are related to this. Also asking that Morgan Neff, the chief investment officer, join me at the table to address some additional questions about that the board may have about what is being recommended in establishing the risk policy. Before getting specifically into the policy itself, what I would like to do and ask the chair's permission is to give a bit of a explanation of what the loan participation program is. I think it may also benefit we have a new board member with Devin Mitchell. I'm sure he's familiar with the program, but it would be good to give a summary ultimately of this that then leads into why we're establishing a risk management policy.
All right. Go ahead.
So the ADAS loan participation program is part of our enterprise development account, which is under statutes 4488-155. And it's a specific program that was put in place to buy participations from local financial institutions within the state of Alaska. Under our statutes, we're able to acquire up to 90% of a loan. Actually, our statutes are defined the fact that the local bank selling to ADA under the program must retain at least 10% of the loan that they're ultimately selling to ADA. The program itself, under its regulations, provides long-term and available fixed-rate funding to Alaska's borrowers, mostly small businesses, middle-market businesses that develop commercial real estate within the state. It also incorporates an element of equipment financing. So with the portfolio itself and what we highlight in the memorandum, particularly on page 2 of our attached memorandum, is that since fiscal year 2017, which ended June 30, 2017, the program itself has grown from roughly $376 million to a current balance as of last reported fiscal year 2021, being June 30, 2021, the state's end of fiscal year, that was had a current balance at that point in time of $445.3 million, but has since reduced with some payoffs within the portfolio to about roughly $422 million. What that recognizes is basically a 6% compounded growth within the program itself. And what I would like to highlight is that particularly the program, it fills a need to providing long-term fixed-rate financing. There is no other alternative source within the state of Alaska predominantly available to Alaska borrowers for long-term fixed rates, which is in a risk-modified category of finance. Other states within the union benefit from real estate investment trusts, pension fund investments, other forms of capital that compete with local financial institutions and therefore provide a set fixed rate for these types of assets. Unfortunately, within the state of Alaska, predominantly this program serves that role. In saying that, we don't compete with the financial institutions. And what I like to highlight is that in the collateral base that ADA has under the $422 million loan portfolio is roughly 6 million square feet office space within the state of Alaska, which is a very decent size and strong support ultimately for the loan program itself. However, it does, based upon national statistics for the state of Alaska, it really represents less than 10% of the available office space. So from all the office spaces being financed within the state, the program itself really comprises less than 10% of that total amount. At the same time, when you look at the financial institutions that do participate within the program, actively participate within it, you have loan growth in their own portfolios over the last 5 years of in excess of 30%. So it's really showing that there's a healthy market within the state of Alaska and that this program itself really fits a specific niche. Now, what are the ultimate benefits that are coming from the program as far as ADA has a mission, statutorily, to enhance job growth within the state of Alaska and to diversify our economy? So the niche that we serve is for those parties that need long-term fixed-rate capital in order to implement their development or to ultimately reinvest and expand their development within the state of Alaska. Since the early 90s, that program has funded in total about $1.2 billion of loans. It has created excess of 10,000 construction jobs. It has also supported in excess of 10,000 jobs in existing businesses through reinvesting and expanding their operations in the state. So it has fulfilled that specific function and that niche that comes into play. The other element that I would say is that we also are enabled to direct capital to areas within the state, in this case totaling about $135 million, small financial institutions to more remote areas of the state that may not have access to broader financing. So the program itself really fulfills that role. So overall, what I would highlight, the program in its history has been very successful in meeting the mission elements of ADA on job growth, economic development, and diversity within the state, while not competing with financial institutions and actually enabling them to do their role, their key role within the state. I would like to highlight one of the comments that's actually in Northrend's financial statements. They're one of the few financial parties within the state that are actually issued public financial statements. They also have a First National, which issues financial statements specifically about Alaska. But within their own financial statements, they really do highlight what the purpose of this loan participation program is. So within the recent 10-K filing with the SEC, Northrend stated that the blend of our and ADA's loan terms allows us to provide competitive long-term financing to our customers while reducing the risk inherent in this type of lending. We also originate and sell to HFC loans secured by multifamily residential units. Typically, 100% of these loans are sold to HFC, and we provide ongoing servicing of the loans for a fee. ADA and HFC make it possible for us to originate these commercial real estate loans and enhance fee income while reducing our exposure to risk. So here's a fairly large participant within the program who's highlighting really how this delivers the benefits across the board for Alaskans and Alaskan borrowers. So having highlighted that, what I'd like to then get into is some of the dynamics behind the discussions on why we would want to establish a risk management policy. With the initiation of the program, again, going back to early parts of the 1980s, back a loan program that was originated with the Department of Revenue, and then about $160 million in loans was transferred to ADA. It was part of the foundation capital for ADA. We have since grown our total capital base from that initial funding of about $200 million with excess cash to a balance sheet position of $1.4 billion net. So it's been continued growth and recycling of capital reinvestment in the state of Alaska. But since that point in time, we have followed and complied with our statutes and our regulations, providing the loan program broadly across the state. Since that point in time, with COVID-19 and the impacts that we have seen through loan modifications, again, with highlighting loan modifications, I would highlight that that is also one of the benefits of the program with ADA as a long-term patient capital provider. We have addressed in excess of $240 million worth of our loan portfolio and modifications, a total of 95 unique loans in that case. But through the discussions with the Budget and Audit Subcommittee in looking at the modifications, what we're looking at, specifically highlighting, is that in certain areas, where obviously larger impacts are happening within the portfolio. And then the question was raised, how is it, as in other institutions, how do they manage a large loan portfolio basis like this? And since that point in time, we've been engaged in looking externally. Our Chief Investment Officer, Morgan Neff, has spent quite a bit of time with our commercial finance director, Tiffany Jansen, to define how we would look at our payment profiles, the risk categories that we have within the loan participation portfolio itself. We are also asked at that point in time to analyze the regional and geographic risk areas within the state. And we address that as well within the memo. So what came from that discussion was a reclassification of our loan participation portfolio based upon the industries that are supporting the underlying collateral base. In this case, it would be either equipment or it's predominantly real estate. And that's what you see on page three and four of the memorandum. Is a breakdown of the potential, you know, the specific repayment industry and where those concentrations ultimately come into play. This was an important part of the exercise, and I really want to address our chair, Albert Fogel, and his specific questions about this, because it highlighted some areas that we were not accounting correctly in our own systems, the repayment industry or the collateral base. So it helped actually going through that with a lot of work from Tiffany Tennyson and her group about correcting the record in this case, the way that we have been aggregating our data. What it highlighted was previously we were looking at a concentration which could be in excess of $100 million into hotels and other tourism-related. This helped us really define the repayment profiles that's behind it. And with that, what I would highlight is that we're looking at a concentration level, and we do talk about the hotel industry, a very critical sector within the state, of, in this case now, roughly $57 million. Versus a number that was in excess of 85, potentially in excess of 100 with initial analysis. And that represents really 14% of our portfolio. So this is the basis that we work with in starting to establish then risk parameters for reporting our concentrations and then how we would look at managing that. The other thing that we looked at was principally best practice within industries. You have entities through the federal government set up business development corporations, which effectively lend. What ADA does is lending to small mid-market businesses, their underlying real estate portfolios, and how they have quantified and report their portfolio and risk management related to that portfolio. And what I would ask at this point in time, Morgan, if you would please give a summary for the board how we looked at the risk profiles and how we were looking at ultimately establishing risk management policy based upon best practice.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Board. I think before we get into the actual underlying risk measurement policies, it probably makes sense to go through the our process as it sits today. Sitting with me is Tiffany Jansen, who's our Commercial Finance Director, who oversees the loan participation program and the team. And I'd ask Tiffany if you wouldn't mind walking through our process as it exists today. That way we can relate it to how the proposals that we are that are in the memo today relate to it.
Good morning, Gordon. Good morning, Chair. So if you look at page four, we talk about the proposed risk management policy, and we start to break down the process of when we start to receive a loan file or a pre-flight. A pre-flight is a one-page form that the department has sent that is basically a snapshot of what the project is going to be to gauge whether ADA would have interest in said project. So that's the first step of any loan package. The next step is they're given a what's called a green light on the pre-flight. Then later on, and this can be weeks or months later, to receive the actual loan package into the commercial finance group, we then will look at the bank's write-up. The bank has done a full underwriting at that point. So we have appraisal, we have environmental. They've already issued their approval. We then underwrite the file independently ourselves. We do an inspection on the property ourselves. And then it's given, depending on the level, all of the packages will start at investment committee for approval. So that gets sent out to the investment committee a few days before. Investment committee is typically held every week. Then that loan will be presented. If it is approved in that form and it is below the amount of $3 million individually for the project or $5 million in aggregate exposure for the borrowers or guarantors, then that will just be decision by investment committee. If it is above the $3 million or $3 million above threshold for individual loan, or again $5 million in aggregate exposure for borrowers or guarantors, it will then proceed to the board. So that is the actual process as we look at it right now, and we're looking at making some small changes to that going forward.
Yes, so if there's not any questions on how our existing process works, what I'd like to walk through is some of the items that we're proposing, which are principally four areas where we're, you know, proposing a risk measurement framework. First, we had to identify what risk we can and cannot control within the loan participation portfolio. That would be primarily liquidity risk and market risk. Liquidity risk really pertains to our ability to sell an underlying position in the portfolio to meet certain liquidity requirements. We are long-term investors with long-term patient capital, so we don't necessarily need that liquidity profile that most normal BDCs or business development companies would have. The other is market. We are proudly only investing in Alaska and will not do anything other than that, so that is not another concern we focused on. The first item that we would really need to address is, in order to set these risk tolerances, is defining the portfolio size. So based on the current review, the loan portfolio was approximately $422 million. When we factored in the pre-flights and the annualized growth over the last 5 years, which has been at about a 6% compounded rate, we're looking at establishing the loan participation fund size at $500 million, which gives us, you know, an approximate level of, you know, 78 million of growth within the next 12 months. The reason why that's important is that's where we start to define the actual risk tolerances for the industry and borrower concentration that I'll go into.
Morning.
Yes, sir.
I got a question. So you say $500 million, is that an annual dollar amount set?
That's actually a great question, Chair. We actually, every quarter, staff will be proposing a loan participation fund allocation size. And it could stay stagnant based on the growth and the current commitments that we see, or we could be proposing to increase that allocation.
Chair, this is Alan Webster. That is a very pertinent question, because that is what we are doing. We are asking for an allocation. That has not been done before. It has been discussed at the end of the year when we do the evaluation on the excess capital for a dividend definition. So we've gone through that exercise at least once a year. However, we're now looking to really fully establish a board-approved level of allocation or funding to the program.
So what's the difference if we don't versus we do? I mean, would that change any pre-flight or any, you know, opportunity for a Alaska business to come in and apply for a loan?
No, that would not change in practice what we're undertaking. What it does is it establishes out of our revolving fund a set level that we are saying is set aside specifically for the loan participation program, something that we have fundamentally been doing but haven't officially been defining.
So I assume it's built in, it doesn't explicitly say it, but for the record, you're also taking into account loan repayments in the existing portfolio for determining sizing need?
That is correct. We're taking the way that the program has behaved over the last 5 years, including the cash flow profile of repayments, prepayments, and then also the compounded new loan origination growth. But again, this is something that we will revisit quarterly. Because as the chairman pointed out, we don't necessarily want to limit the ability for us to fund any Alaskan or Alaskan businesses through the loan participation program. So the staff will be prepared on a quarterly basis to either assume the current level or suggest a higher amount.
Through the chair, board member Mitchell, the loan portfolio program itself has revolved generally on about 7 to 8 year cycle. Now, these are 20 to 25 year loans, but there is a repayment element that's in there. One of the things that we do have to account for, and that is with the setting of the capital allocation, is the assumption that we will not have the same level of repayments based upon the lower interest rates that borrowers you know, over the last few years have been able to embed into the program.
I can take a quick brief at ease and talk with you for a minute. Okay? Is that all right? Thanks.
All right.
All right, Alan, go ahead.
Chair, you are on the record.
Thank you.
I would ask Morgan if you would continue with explaining the categories that we're looking to establish. And the one thing I would like to identify, too, is that within the memorandum, so no, this is not one of the categories you're going to be defining, is that we have specifically stated that there will not be a geographic diversification requirement, that under our statutes, we're available to every borrower across the island of Alaska, working with every financial institution doing business within the state of Alaska that's qualified under the program. So we're not asking to make any distinction on a regional basis. It comes down to industry and the way that we're looking to manage the risk categories and risk mitigation elements of that.
Thank you, Alan. To also follow along, we've designed a flowchart on the proposed risk measurements that we're discussing, some data that follows that I'll be discussing along with what you're seeing written in front of you. The next one we're talking about is borrower concentration. Borrower regulation data is already limited to not exceed $25 million on a single loan. We're looking at and recommending that we establish that as also the individual borrower limitation to reduce our risk at the borrower level as well, and that would be on an aggregate amount. So if you're looking at the $500 million allocation pool that we are proposing, that would be $25 million or 5% of the portfolio.
Morgan, so how long ago is that $25
million
put in place?
On the borrower?
Or $25 million.
That was put in place with the, I believe, towards the end of 2000, or before 2000, 1998, 1999 was when $25 million. It was previously $10 million. It was increased to $25 million.
All right, so with inflation, I hate to say that word today, with inflation, what's that $25 million today?
I don't have that calculation in front of me, but we can come back to you and get you the number.
I just want to make sure it's not this
$28 million.
I just want to make sure that, you know, $25 million in 1999 to 2000 is not $25 million in 2022. And so by putting that limit on there, I just want to make sure that you know the actual what we can actually deploy. But so if we need to revisit that number,
gotcha,
because of inflation.
If we increased it from 500,000 to 600,000 and used the 5%, would that make it 30 million?
You mean the 600 million?
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't change what we already have defined statutorily and from a regulatory perspective.
Okay.
So we would be limited at the individual borrower at the 600 million at 5%, which would be 30 million.
That was my question.
Mr. Chairman. Morgan, thank you for putting this together, and as we discussed in the budget and audit subcommittee back in March, my concern is putting a cap at $500 million. We don't want to miss out on any opportunities to help Alaskans, and so how hard is that $500 million cap?
The $500 million cap is revisited quarterly, and what I'd like to do is ask Tiffany to talk about if we have brief lights that are coming in that bump up to some of our limitations that we're proposing today, what we're also proposing as flexible terms and structure for the board to consider.
All right, so we've put a measure in here on page 6 that talks about under industry concentrations, if a lender submits loans that ADASAP believes meets all the program metrics, but we are hitting up on the cap very near, sort of exceeded it, that it can go through the normal levels of approval, get a conditional approval for 6 months, which is our normal approval time right now, with the idea of the industry decreases the concentration to a suitable amount, that it then would not have to be revisited for approval. So we wouldn't necessarily reject anyone at the gate. We would have the ability to have that loan go through the normal process.
So the $500 million is a floating ceiling.
Based on the structure we're talking about, where we come in and we would propose an increase to that cap, correct, on a quarterly basis.
Thank you. And Tiffany, how much is in pre-flight How much? Give me a dollar value for the number of loans that we have in pre-pledge status right now.
Right now, we're exceeding about $50 million.
Okay.
So we're bumping up close to the 500. Yeah.
And
Albert had my concern, too, is that perception-wise, if we've got a cap, which I guess what the definition of a cap is, and we're pushing up against it, and someone comes in and spends all the time and effort and money to go through the process, the pre-flight, to ultimately hopefully get approved, the last thing we want them to do is run into some type of issue where we got this cap, right? I mean, it's not a capacity issue, it's a self-imposed capacity issue. It's one thing if you don't have the capacity to make the loan or make the investment. It's quite another if you put a cap out there, but you have the capacity, and how you transmit that to the public so that they don't get confused and they don't think that I'm going to, and they're not going to know what you got in pre-flight.
Mm-hmm.
All they're going to know is that goes up and down, changes based on your due diligence and whatnot, and ultimately what ultimately gets approved. And so I just don't want to, my personal belief is that I don't want to limit that.
Mm-hmm.
If there's an opportunity out there and we have the resources within statutory approval and regulations that we look at all opportunities for Alaska businesses.
To the chair, to the board, then, what I would recommend is we revise the memorandum that identifies it as a number allocation for the purposes of the quantification of the industry caps. And that's really how we're using that number. Because we definitely take the comments to heart, and it is a function that we have talked about, and the way that the policy actually works is that we remain open for business for all Alaskan borrowers.
That's what I want to hear, Alan.
Yes.
Well, we don't want to turn anyone away. We want to try and be an economic development engine of Alaska. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, Alan, the limits that are established in this policy would be based on the authorized cap rather than the existing loan balance?
We need to start off with some number.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to really set where we're reporting, where this new loan, say it's a new loan that's adding into it, would fall into a certain industry repayment to be able to identify it or more diversify it.
Yeah.
It also serves the function that as we look at other sources of capital to grow the program, that we need to report to those borrowers of potentially these receivable bonds that in this case would be looking at the security of the loan portfolio as a whole, that there's risk mitigation measures in place, and we are able to report on those. But we're not intending in any course of removing the ability of this board or the functioning investment committee of the staff to approve loans that continue to grow the portfolio.
Thanks. I think that's beneficial because it means there will be a lot more continuity to the program through time, that you won't have a balance where maybe some segment of your portfolio has another opportunity for financing and pays itself off, thereby boosting the percentage of the rest of the portfolio as a percentage of the outstanding loans. I want to just put on the record this little sidebar that we had about some of the reasoning, and maybe you were going to get to this, I don't know, I don't want to jump in front of you, but for this policy is that at some point this portfolio could be leveraged similar to any revolving fund where you, and AHSC does this all the time, of course, and other, the Student Loan Corporation used to do it, and I'm sure Data has done it in various forms in the past as well, where you can make additional loans by securitizing the loan repayments that you already have in your pool, and by creating this policy and the standardization that it represents, it allows third-party, whether they're credit rating agencies or investors, to look at this portfolio and make an investment decision and know what the sideboards are and how it's going to work through time. And so it's the first step, like we were talking about, to getting on a path where that could be an option that's available, not that anybody's suggesting it today.
Yeah, through the chair, this is an initiative that Alan and I identified at the onset of my
my term here as Chief Investment Officer, is to identify ways for balance sheet initiatives for efficiency of capital and deployment. And this being the size that it is and being what, you know, you would see out in the market as a fairly standard way of utilizing that balance sheet, these are necessary steps to get to a conclusion and successful program around it.
To the board, it's one of the elements that we've talked about us maintaining a sustainable financial position. So while we manage the capital that we have in place and making sure that we have it available for the future project investments that are needed in the growth of this portfolio, we do need to establish external access to capital markets. In that way, we're really defining the cost of capital. In large part, I think we're going to be lowering our cost of capital and then be able to reinvest that within the state. It's all with the mindset of sustainability of the institution.
So, a couple quick questions for me. Hopefully, you'll spur more questions. So, if in an inflationary and anticipated higher interest rates over the next 12 to 24 months, what does that do to that possibility of going to the markets that are fixed rates at these rates?
We actually just spoke about that. I think what we offer there is, I mean, the fixed rate obviously is a little bit different, but there's a large component of investors that are looking for that fixed rate. But the biggest component is that there's the market typically doesn't have any exposure in Alaska. And that makes it a great diversification tool from a blended standpoint in a total portfolio construction scenario. So I think we have a very good ability to go out and look at this portfolio with the market and for there to be interest because it adds something that they don't have nor have they ever had exposure to.
So as an individual board member, I do have some concerns of 420 on the books, 50 plus in the pipeline, and a $500 million cap. So what are your thoughts if we increase that to, say, $600 million?
That is why we're here today to propose what we are suggesting and looking for the appropriate feedback from our board to make those adjustments.
Yeah, unfortunate perception kind of rules, you know, in the public thing, you know, and so anyway, I just throw that out. I look for board comments, but I mean, we're within 20 million of the cap already, and I'm just curious, why 500 on that, have some headroom there.
To the chair, our thought process was to be conservative. If the board chooses to allocate a higher amount really for our soft cap application, it doesn't change anything in the way that we propose it. It just adjusts the numbers on what can ultimately come under these industry categories.
I agree with Dana. I think we should be ready for any market changes, and being so close to that cap makes me nervous as well. I echo his thoughts. Let's, as quick as we can, move that cap to 600.
So
we're talking about a cap, but in budget and audit, it's an allocation.
That's right.
It's going to change on a quarterly basis. We're going to see this number every 3 months. And so my question at that meeting was, you know, when we allocate that additional, say, $78 million today, we can't use it for anything else. So if you make it $178 million, we can't use that for other things.
It becomes like
it's right. So, I mean, it is fluid. So I don't think that we thought it was unreasonable at that time. But I completely agree that, you know, we are open for business. We want to see the deals. There needs to be a way that we can see those if they don't fall within that number that the board gets to see those, and we're not trying to business with. I agree, but I mean, as opposed to a cap, it's just an allocation, right?
Okay. It's just perception and ability that we are here for business. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Randy Ellidge. So we cannot predict the future. We cannot predict how much inflation we're going to see even this year. Our crystal ball is not very good. With that quarterly review, can we adjust that $500 million at that time? Or is that too fluid for the industry?
No, that's actually what we're suggesting, is that the quarter, it is a quarterly review, and that we have the flexibility and the ability to be that fluid with the capital allocation portion of this program.
I would also add that we included a pre-flight management screen, so anything over the 2%, or in this case $10 million, the board will be aware of before the entire loan package is received. So they will see it at the pre-flight level, so at that time that would give, I think, adequate notice to be able to change the allocation.
Thank you, Morgan.
Yeah, and with that, maybe you can go a little bit into that. Well, let me go first into the industry concentration. That way we can tie it into the pre-flight. Really, what was one of the leading drivers of this measurement and framework was looking at our industry exposure. And Tiffany and her team have spent countless hours defining our revenue exposure based, and then defining that as our industry concentration. What we're looking at doing is establishing a 25% or less industry concentration based on the revenue of the underlying business. And then it's coupled even further that the top five industries cannot make up more than 50% of the portfolio. This limits you the ability to have four industries representing 100% of the portfolio. And so if you look on the diagram that I on in green, you will see, based on the $500 million allocation pool, we are currently at 43.46% of the top five industry allocations, which include hotel, tourism, healthcare, real estate mixed use, and government. Any questions around that?
No, I'm just thinking that maybe we should go in a quick executive session to discuss the cap. I can't make the motion, I can ask.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a motion that we go into the executive session to discuss the allocation cap for our loan participation portfolio.
This is Bill Kennedy, you got a second?
Is there an objection? Be quick. Hearing none, we'll go into executive session for roughly 15 minutes.
All right, you are on the record.
I will make a statement that the board did not take any action upon executive session on this first portfolio management policy. So I'll let you continue. Kevin?
Mr. Chair, I would propose that the board consider amendments to the risk management policy that would provide for an allocation of between $500 and $750 million for the program, and for purposes of allocation, that the cap still be the allocation be $500 million for determining percentages of risk, but that allocation for risk determination could be reviewed quarterly by the board for update.
All right. Staff, any issue with that?
What we would like to propose, and you know, for the discussion of that, is that as opposed to the quarterly reporting that would come with allocation, because the intention is, again, to have not an active hard cap, and we don't want to dissuade any potential party from a loan application or pre-flight to us, is that we manage the reporting of the industry concentrations with our monthly reports. We would amend our monthly reports on that basis, and you would see that those allocations are coming into play. We would apply the policy as we're proposing, and then in this case, there are going to be times that loans, if it does exceed a certain industry concentration, would require us actually bringing it to the board in that process. You would see it at that point in time for, again, not a cap in place, but really an identification that there's a higher concentration, which could be ultimately approved by the board by exemption. And then we would look at ultimately really fully defining the level of the band as we have the discussions in December with the level of capital that we're looking at for the following year and its commitments. Because it's not just the loan participation portfolio that our revolving fund is focused on. It is a key driver this winter. However, we are looking at our other development project finance opportunities. There's commitments that we have for Amber Access Project. There's commitments that we have for Section 1002 development. We have a development pipeline that exceeds 15 projects that could be $1 billion worth of development finance from ADA. At least has been requested at this time. So with those conversations about the available capital for future growth needed within ADA, we will look at establishing the range at that point. That's what we would like to propose.
Kevin, you are with that?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Bill?
So with the 500 to 750 band, how then are we, how much money would not be available for other investments at any given time? So that number is set at 500 now and ratchets up. So
We would not be defining specifically that the capital in a revolving fund is unavailable to other investments. It is an allocation that within it we are doing our budgeting on the utilization of that funds, the way that we're also looking at near-term obligations for development project finance and future obligations that we have to hold in reserve. So we would be managing that as we have always been over the last few years and reporting on in that December discussion with the board. But the underlying reporting of specifically the risk allocation levels within the loan participation program would be on a monthly ongoing basis with the industry concentrations. So let me reduce it to what I understand on a number basis. So if we are at 422 and we are looking at 500 million being the closest whole number, right, for us to do our levels at it. If we have pre-flights and through the process with investment committee and with the board approval levels, have now a portfolio, let's say within 6 months, in excess of 500, we would internally adjust that level to 550, and then we would keep moving it within the band that's been proposed up to a level of 750. I believe that would really provide the From our historical understanding of the program, what we see in pre-flights, I think that really is a fairly broad band that we can work with that would not impose a limitation on any Alaskan borrower.
Further questions? Albert, as chair of the subcommittee, are you good with this?
I believe that having a band between 500 to 750 million signals to the Alaska community that we're open for business and we're not going to turn away any Alaskan that would like to come for us for assistance. So I approve of that band.
All right. So I continue on the
yes. But policy? What I would ask is we talked about a lot of aspects of it, and of course the memorandum has been available. The memorandum has also been available to the public for the review, and in the March 29th EAS, same levels as what we're having the current memo before the board. So what I would ask, unless there's any other specific questions about how we're looking to manage industry elements, I would like to talk and really identify for the board the change in the procedures that we're proposing as it comes to pre-flights, because this does involve an additional element of board review that comes into play, that we're trying to match how we handle our development project finance program. Under that program, with the board's process in place, we have a two-step presentation process. So initially, on anything that's coming to us under 4488-172 or our...
I do have one question, though, if you want to, before...
Sorry, Chair, go ahead.
So to me, hotel and tourism are the same. It's the same concentration and risk, although you broke it out. And based on our experience the last 3 years, and that's showing $106 million of 400, so it's whatever. But you did break it out. So
I believe Tiffany might have an answer.
I know hotels have additional customers other than tourism business, but we have such a high concentration of hotels
in the communities. I'm just interested to hear about that and how you would manage that almost related businesses, even though they're separate.
Yeah. Chair, we had a robust conversation on that with the Budget and Audit Subcommittee.
Why am I not surprised?
I would ask Morgan and Tiffany to give you some background on that and why we are proposing a breakout between the two.
Thank you, Chair and Board members. Thank you, Alan, as well. So hotels, it does represent that are they getting majority of revenue coming from visitor industry? They could be, but they don't necessarily rely completely on the visitor industry to survive. So there are conferences. They do have intimate people that come. And also a different type of collateral inherently. In the tourism, it can be something nothing more than some picnic tables and a day excursion type of place. So it does represent fundamentally a different type of industry there where there's in many cases an existing building like a hotel that can be utilized for different things. Again, it is also getting revenue maybe from potentially a different source. So it's not heavily reliant necessarily on cruise ship industry coming in, whereas a lot in that tourism breakout would, because they can't pick up revenue from another source, if that makes sense. They're really focused in on one single type of revenue coming in versus a hotel, which can look at many different types of travelers and things that can be held there, if that makes sense.
Well, I just kind of looked at Juneau and the Baranoff. Right?
Very close.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a hotel, the tourism went away, and we've got the session, which is the busiest part of the state for 180 days. I don't know, depends on how many sessions, and the hotel's closed, and that hotel would be full during that part of the season, but no tourism. So that's what brings me to think it's so related, and here's a hotel that's been there forever, kind of an institution in our capital that's closed because of tourism. So, and I never been, you know, 30 years resident down there, or maybe longer. From a standpoint as far as which hotels are full, in my historical move going to Juneau, most of the time, if I don't make a reservation early, you can't get into Juneau, into the Baranoff Hotel during the session. So, again, that's why I'm concerned about splitting them, but yet they're so...
Well, your example is interesting, right? Because you're identifying actually one of the key risk factors that we had quite a bit of discussion about, which was the fact that you have a hotel, as you've identified, right, the Baranoff, but session is independent of tourism, and that was driving occupancy at the hotel. The way we looked at it is that you have, particularly between hotels and the other tourism category, distinct difference in your collateral base, which is a larger investment, larger building that's within the state of Alaska. The way that we're looking at bringing it back into a risk mitigation process, you know, individual related to collateral and purpose, is in the category where we talk about the top five and not having a concentration in excess of 50%. What you see is a key driver within that top five is going to be hotel and tourism. I believe within the state of Alaska, particularly with the collateral pool we focus on in the loan participation portfolio, and I don't believe I covered this, and I should have, and I apologize. The requirements under 4488.155 is a collateral base supporting our loans. And the way that we manage it is predominantly through a first lien collateral position in that underlying security. So with the difference, we saw it again, with the total pool of five always coming into play, and we would have, that is a key driver with tourism, into that top five level. So we saw limitations, you know, being able to address mitigation.
This is Devin again. And I think that's one of the most difficult things about this is trying to categorize. You could look at this list, and I mean, what's the difference between real estate daycare and real estate services? I mean, isn't daycare a service? I mean, so I assume, I don't know, but I'm hopeful that staff looked at external categorizations that are acceptable to the broad market and incorporated those into this policy. And I would I mean, one more government, $32 million, 8%, well, what kind of government? Is it, you know, a utility? Which utility is separate in here? But it could be a variety of governmental commitments. That's kind of my world. And they range significantly and can represent significant diversity within that court category as well, where you could
the LIO and Infrage.
It wouldn't be a bad bet now. But in any event, I don't know if staff could give any input on market expectations or standardization for how these categorizations will manage.
Good Chair, Board Member Ted Mitchell. We absolutely did benchmark the way we categorize our industries through best practices and industry standards, which took a comprehensive analysis of not only the publicly traded, you know, REITs, but also mortgage REITs, which is really what we are. If you want to look at that portfolio, it's more classified as a mortgage REIT, and looked at how they dissected and broke out their industry concentration. And so this is reflective of that analysis.
Well, that answers my question. I just want to bring it up and get on the record.
So if we could, I'm not sure if we got yet to the way that we're defining for the pre-flex. That is a critical change in our process.
Yes, thank you, Alan, to the chair. So we did make one change to the pre-flex that we are recommending, and that is what I briefly mentioned earlier. That if it exceeds the lower band, which would be 2% of the $500 million or $10 million, right now the pre-flights do not go to the board, even if they're eventually going to go to the board because of individual loan amount or aggregate loan amount. We are suggesting to change that and to change it to the 2% of that lower band, so or $10 million. So if we receive the pre-flight, as $10 million that would then go to the board to be seen. In addition to that, what we'd like to require in order for the board to understand more of what the project is about, the snapshot that we spoke about earlier, the one page, would be insufficient. So what we are recommending to do is to basically do what the private sector already does when they get a loan package from a borrower. They're going to underwrite it all the way through to before they request the appraisal and the environmental. So we are asking for the same things that the private sector would do. We would then, if it does reach that level, it will then go to the board for them to look at. And this will avoid premature costs to the borrower. They don't have to shell out money for an appraisal or an environmental for a project that ANA may not have the appetite for. But it also allows us to understand the pipeline, what's coming down, better allow us to manage that allocation in band. But that is the two major changes. So basically, again, taking that $10 million number off of the lower allocation band for $500 million would come to the board, but not come in its present pre-flight form, but come in an actual full underwriting without the final appraisal and final environmental. If the board were to green light that pre-flight, we would then take that back to the lender. The lender would then work with the borrower to order the final appraisal and environmental, at which point it will come back to the board to be represented. Very much like they do in direct finance now, where the board sees a snapshot of that that project and then it comes back. So that would be the major change here on page 6.
Thank you, Tiffany, for that explanation. At what point would you and your team go out for a site inspection?
Anything that we bring to a committee or board has to be seen on site, so we would see that prior to it arriving there.
Thank you.
Don't we have a policy of anything over $1 million?
Policy for over $1 million to do a site visit? Well, not specifically. What we have is a policy that says that for anything that is coming to the committees, in this case is every loan participation, we have a site inspection.
Okay.
So it's not handed over $1 million, it's everything.
Since I have been here, we have visited every site.
Just for the board's understanding, I thought because they never looked at anything. And they just relied on what the bank said. We were taking up to 90% of the risk. And so it was a challenge, but my first question when along came was, did you go look at it? No, you go look at it. Finally, they kind of got the memo. Now I'm looking at everything, so I think it's great.
You're working with her.
That's just good. So, just so the board understands, we started at zero.
And just to be fair, that was mostly an old staff. They are to be commended for the job.
Absolutely.
Sure, if I may add something. Thank you. Well, all of the things that we have proposed today are designed to enhance and make this program more efficient. And as board member Vogel said, you know, we are open for business. We also wanted to make sure that nothing we were proposing was going to be, drastically encumbering on the board and the process. So we went back and anecdotally looked at what this materiality threshold would have created from a board involvement. And since 1997, 13 loans would have been brought through the board through this pre-flight screening process, totaling $198 million. So while we think it's an incredible step to help further mitigate the loan participation portfolio's process, we also see that it's not being overly intrusive of and encumbering the process through through what Tiffany and her team are managing.
So one of the questions from perception standpoint is, does the board see the rejected pre-floats?
Well, I think in the case of this, it would come to the board. In the case of the 2% or $10 million.
How about I put it another way? If we were to see that on a monthly basis or a quarterly basis, then when the board got a phone call about a pre-flight that they had knew nothing about, because of the Republic, you will hear this all the time, and then the wrong message gets out in the public about how ADA may or may not participate the appropriate way. How would you best inform us that we understand what you're doing? Because obviously I don't want to burden you with bureaucracy, but at the end of the day, our phones do ring, at least mine, that if there is a rejection or a taken forever, comment, and of course, there's probably two sides of the story. I'm just looking at information that I can confirm. Maybe it's a quarterly basis. You're going to have the pre-flights, they're in process, the name of those, and then ones that we never see are rejected, maybe. I mean, that's one of the issues with ADA as far as the public and perception that we have today.
To the chair, we can certainly add a report on a quarterly basis that gives you an update on it. But I would like to take a step back and talk about process a bit, because what we have internally is an investment committee. And then, based upon certain parameters, it goes to the board. Or if it's a modification, it goes to the budget audit subcommittee and then to the board. So in every case, when there's a discussion on a pre-flight, it's internally within staff. So if something is not progressing past investment committee, there are noted reasons why from staff perspective, that's not meeting the requirements or the mission or the regulations ultimately of the loan participation portfolio. And then that gets communicated to the underlying bank. We have spent a lot of time, and I would highlight this is with Tiffany Jensen coming on and really managing that group. And this is also with Morgan Neff and his, with the loan participation program being part of the oversight with the chief investment officer position. We've really focused on the day turnaround that a loan sits within ADA. And we've actually documented that now on the applications. It's to address the issue that there is a quick response, there's a quick turnover, and to that extent, if someone is receiving the information that is saying it's not progressing internally, they get it very quickly. It's not getting delayed.
Well, as we know, many times it's not ADA that's the challenge time-wise. Well, ADA is blamed for the challenge time-wise by the banks, right, by the process. So what I understand it. I'm just trying to, something that, again, there's an acceptance and a rejection. give me a quarterly report that says all the applications. I don't know if you have a lot of rejections.
Mr. Chairman.
I mean, yes or no? What percentage of your pre-flights are rejected?
It's a very low percentage. I don't have the exact number, but I can tell you in practice, it's low. We have a robust conversation on the pre-flights that are coming through.
And I would say, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. It is overall a low percentage that I would say that we don't green light, but more often than not, there are questions that can't be answered. So many times we'll get a pre-flight and it won't contain the sufficient information. And so we will ask some questions, and the lender is not able to answer those questions. The borrower is not able to answer those questions. They're not willing to take the next step to do that. So in some cases, I would call those conditions, where we look at them and say, okay, we've asked some questions on this, but we don't hear a response back.
Mr. Chairman, I think what you're seeing now is a shift in ADA policy of being more reactive and now being proactive, and so that we're able to start seeing what's coming down the pike instead of just being senseless what's being reviewed at that time at the board. And that's really through the direction of Morgan, Allen, and Tiffany that we're able to start getting on top of this and understanding what's coming through the pipeline. So thank you.
Anyway, I appreciate that for you. Okay. Go ahead, continue.
Chair, I think we've concluded the last portion of this was talk about the pre-flight, the materiality provision, and unless Tiffany has anything else.
I think we walked through the process unless anyone has any questions on that new pre-flight process, because that is a distinct change.
Okay. Well, it's great that you were doing this.
Albert? Could you, Tiffany, and Morgan, could you explain to the board members, since you have a couple new ones, that the last two pages of the memo where it goes over the graphs and looks at the diversity of participation loans via regional and also by collateral.
Thank you, Reverend McCobalt. Yeah, so we did include, at the end of your packet there, regional diversity participation loans. This is something that is part of the loan dashboard. We've included it here. This is just the loan participation. It does not include direct finance. And it gives you an understanding of our loans in process, applications in process, so and loan participation active. So new loans in process are ones that we have approved and we are waiting for them to fund. New applications in process are just that, going through the process. They are not active and approved for funding as of yet. And that then details in the different regions from the northern all the way down to the southeast where all of that is located. And you can kind of see where the concentrations are. The other graph is something that we have updated recently. So before we had something called industry diversity, which really was just a conglomeration of industry and collateral types. We have broken that out into NAICS industry code, which also comes as part of the dashboard. And then this collateral diversity, which is brand new that we've done, this is another time that we've gone reorganizing the portfolio by collateral type. And so that meant the staff and I going through each of our loans and actually putting the building classes. So you can see the building class A, B, C, D, and the distinct types of collateral that we actually have in the portfolio. You can get a better understanding of, I think, along with this repayment industry, what's actually making the payment, and then giving you the distinct collateral types down the building class.
I have a question on the, I've been asked this for years now. So when you look at how you define what the region is, I noticed that you, in some areas you put a geographical region like Southwest, but then you put a political region like Matsu or Anchorage as far as the delineation of where they're located at. And I'm curious about that because, it's either a region is a region, not a municipality, and I don't know, I guess, what the ramifications, why this was done this way.
Like South Central.
Yeah, or South Central, or you know, I don't know. South Central would be, you know, something like Anchorage to Homer versus
the Matthew Bird borough to the Denali borough, up to. Just curious if there's an answer to that.
Did you want to speak to the historical original, how it was set up in the past?
Historically, there's distinct collateral pools, business concentration areas. So the business development ultimately has happened in Matsu being distinct from what development ultimately comes in. If a company is looking at their headquarters, they're concentrating in Anchorage, but their operations may be somewhere else. To give some historical context as well, Chair, to the way that things were quantified, and we're trying to really define what's the best way that we can present our data, because the data is the critical element here. And from us being able to report that data, we're able to make cogent decisions that are attached with it. So previously, what was going on was the business address, irrespective of where the collateral itself was located, was the way things were being reported. We changed that. Tiffany and her group have gone through, and as she's highlighted, have gone through each and every individual loan for this, because I just want, if you bear with me, please, I want to identify this, because our previous processes of data collection was purely paper-based. This was all in individual files. It was not recorded on our loan system, and we're trying to actually pull that data out to put it onto a loan system that itself was structured not to undertake this kind of data. So in going through all of this, we noticed that the way the data was being reported on regions wasn't absolutely correct, so that had to be updated on where the buildings are located. And then it's working with the existing regions the way that has been reported within the loan participation program over the last 15, 16 years. So if you want to have a change right at this point, this would be the time to do it, because we're really putting it into our systems. I'm just relaying to you the fact that the way it's been historically presented is because distinctly Matsu is a different, it's a business operation is defining that region or that area for its own investment and growth, which is they're making a distinct decision outside of putting that within Anchorage for their own purposes, and that there are several large concentrations that come regionally there, diverse than the other regions across the state. So that's the only reason why that was broken out.
Well, again, I just curious, when I think of the northern region, I don't think of going all the way down south of Fairbanks on the west coast of Alaska as being northern region, right? I mean, so that I just ask, you may want to revisit a little bit and be more, that's reflective of where we're at and what it is. That's all. And, the northern region essentially goes down to the equivalent latitude of Denali Park on the west coast. So that's, and then you've got Anchorage. Should it say the municipality of Anchorage? Should it say Matthew Borough? Should it say, the interior region has got Fairbanks. There's 100-some thousand people there, but yet it's huge area, right? So rural is a big component of the interior region, where the Anchorage region is all urban, or the Anchorage area, I guess. So I just actually revisit that and maybe more reflective of what it truly it is.
Okay, we can absolutely undertake that.
Again, to me, what happens is when you start delineating by regions, be careful what you ask for. Kevin?
I think it holds true for both Anchorage and Matsu as well as the rural areas. Like you said, Bethel versus Dillingham, if you looked at northern regions, it's probably Nome, Kotzebue, and
it's below Nome, Kotzebue.
I'm just saying the communities that actually have participations are probably relatively limited because the village isn't, I don't know how much participation you have in villages, but
right.
It's probably highly concentrated in specific little points in a huge region, which I don't know, where
specific
do you start?
Well, you think today, you think of northern region, you think of everything north of the Bush Range.
Yeah, no, I would agree that the categorization of
the interior region is everything south of the Bush Range and north of the Alaska Range. That is my head, right? I've been meaning to ask this. I just keep forgetting to ask the question because I thought it was odd how it was broken out.
All of it addresses this is that now is a good time for us to start addressing these particular questions because we have actually gone through each, I mean, we're talking over 280 files.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone through to define exactly where the collateral is located, not the business enterprise. It could easily be that there was a building that is in Bethel, but the company itself has for its license, headquarters, and Anchorage, and it was previously documented as Anchorage.
Okay. All right.
So at this stage, we are asking for the board if you would be willing to put forward a motion to adopt this policy.
With the recommended changes that we talked about?
In this case, we're talking about recommending changing the capital allocation level, which was originally proposed at 500, into a band of 500 to 750 million to be managed by staff and reported within the monthly loan participation and commercial finance reporting that we do through the director's comments. So that would be monthly towards the board. And then we would visit this directly on the December board meeting with the general discussions of total capital.
Okay. All right, so I'll undertake a motion to loan participation program risk management policy dated April 13, 2022 with the board recommended changes.
This is Albert. So moved.
Bill Kennedy, second.
Is there any more further discussion? Is there any objection? Policy passes. Not a resolution, so we don't have to have a formal vote.
Yep. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Board. So we're next on new business is resolution 22. There's one I noticed at noon. Our lunches are here. So why don't we take 15 minutes to grab our lunches, take a break, we'll come back, and we'll continue to work while we're having our lunch. So we'll go off the record. Welcome back, everybody, from our little lunch break here. It's 12:25, Stephen, just so you know. We'll go to item number B under new business, resolution number L22-01, 824 Northwest 52nd, LLC. Alan?
Chair, before the board is resolution number L2201, which is resolution of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority regarding purchase by the authority of a participation in 824 Northwest 52nd, LLC. So attached and also was available for the public is a memorandum, which is talking about the loan application and proposal before the board for a $3.7 million loan. The issue or participation by ADA in a total $4.3 million loan. Our participation would be at a fixed rate of 4.24% over 25 years. I do ask that our commercial finance director, Tiffany Jansen, join me and please give a summary of the proposal to the board and be available for questions.
I would like to make sure Julie Sandy, are you on with us? Make sure you're...
Yep, I'm on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, board members. Thanks to Alan. So we're going to be looking at 824 Northwest 52nd LLC today. We've also provided a presentation of the inspection of the facility in Fairbanks, which we have on the screen. Was also provided to the public. We want to go to the first slide, if you could, Randy. Thank you. This gives you the location of where it's located in Fairbanks. So I'll start with letting you know this is a North Minnesota lender on this. They have requested ADA's participation initially at a 90% level, so that would have been just under $3.9 million. However, after we completed the loan review, we found that there was enough building and tenant risk that we wanted to adjust that down to an 85% participation, so that brings us to a $3.6 million participation at the 4.24%. That is what it was at the time it went to committee, and for a 25-year term. The guarantors on this will be the Harrison's Living Trust and Duncan and Danielle Harrison. They purchased the building in Fairbanks last fall, so this loan would be to pay off the short-term bridge loan. Often a purchase transaction needs to go very quickly, and to get it through ADA financing, especially at board level, we have a certain calendar date that needs to happen, and so Northrim provided them a short-term bridge loan for that purpose. but we still do look at it as a purchase because it was, again, just a short-term bridge loan. So because of that, you will see that there has been an adjustment on the value. Our purchase price was slightly lower than the appraised value. We take whichever is lesser, so it's 75% of that. This is a Class B space, if you'll go on to the next slide. This is in an industrial area off of Van Horn in Fairbanks. It's surrounded by many of the same type of warehouse slash retail buildings. This has about 80% warehouse, 20% retail, so you have a shop for people to come in. Ferguson, this building was built for Ferguson. They have been in that facility for the past 35 years. They have just recently signed a new lease to further for another 5 years. The tenant improvements were built specifically for them. It's a large building at 31,000 square feet, Class B. It was constructed in the 80s, and it sits on about 2.02 acres. You can see that it's got a lot of space to deal with for parking. Kind of the next one. This just shows you some of the access.
Excuse me, just want to say, for the public that's listening, if you can identify the slide that we're on. We're on slide 4 now.
Yes, we're on slide 4. Sorry about that. So this is access off of the 30th Avenue. So if we go to the next slide, please. And so this is the docking and the entrance. So it kind of gives you a closer view on slide 5 of what the building looks like from the front. They do sell to the public, primarily used by contractors, HVAC, and plumbing supplies. Ferguson Enterprises is the U.S.'s largest distributor of plumbing and HVAC supplies. They have over 1,600 locations. So if we go to the next slide, we'll see a little bit more what it looks like inside. So they have a showroom, as you can see on the right on slide 6, and some of the retail parts displayed on the left. We want to go to slide 7. We can see a bit about what the other 80% of the space looks like. So it's a very well-done warehouse, very well-maintained. This is a triple net lease, where even Ferguson keeps up the maintenance on the facility. Go up to the next one. This will give you a little bit maintenance of electrical panels, boiler, furnace. You can see, again, that it's been well-maintained in this an area. Keep going. And this is outside storage. They're on 2 acres, so there's quite a bit of area for parking, for storage. It's a large lot, which is not unusual in that area of town. And this is on slide 9. So I kind of want to get back into, now that we've kind of seen what it looks like, you can see that it's got a good quality and condition. The economic life of the collateral is 35 years, so we cannot exceed 75% due to regulations. So therefore, this is within the guidelines. It is 100% owner-occupied, will continue to be 100% owner-occupied by, tenant-occupied by Ferguson Enterprises. And the debt service is 1.321, which is within our current policy guidelines based upon their current lease. So one of the things that we wanted to talk about here, one, we lowered the participation percentage for a couple of different reasons. Number one, there are some larger buildings in Fairbanks that when those tenants have vacated those buildings, they're very difficult to get another tenant of a similar size in Fairbanks to take that over. We've seen that in Anchorage as well. This is a large building for the area, 31,000 square feet. It's in an industrial area. So while we have no indications that a tenant has any plans to vacate, in fact, we have a renewal of a lease, there is an issue potentially in the future if Ferguson did decide to exit the space, that a similar tenant that would need that large of a space may be difficult to find in the future. So that is something that we've looked at. It's also, since it's in an industrial area, it doesn't sit on the main thoroughfare of town, So this is something else that we looked at again, considering the size of the building and the reliance on a single tenant to make that repayment. One of the other things that we looked at with this note, you'll see that there is a related debt. Our aggregate total exposure after refinances, which I'll speak about in a moment, is of $5,442,000. The proposed note, again, is 3.68. The remaining loan that the Harrisons will have is 1.752. The other two loans they currently have on the portfolio is for Eagle River Building. Current balance is about $950,000, and Harrison Properties at $877,000. In order to comply with ADA's statutes and regulations, ADA worked with the lender, in this case Northrim, to add a condition to have Northrim take over these two notes, 100%. They will be Northrim notes, so that we, again, can comply with the statutes and regulations to get this deal done. One of the things I want to mention is there were no tenant concessions or modifications due to the pandemic. Guarantor did not require funds, COVID funds, in order to continue making payments. Neither of those loans that are being refinanced nor the loan that is staying on the books with ADA required any modifications during COVID. There also was a phase one completed on the property. No environmental, no additional action was needed. There had been some fire environmental issues on properties close, but that has been remedied and no additional action needed at this time.
Okay, so let me back you up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I read in there that the groundwater is contaminated.
Right, we gave a...
The property next door.
The property next door.
So did you confirm it was on this property?
So this is from the environmental. So they go out and actually do the survey of the property.
Did they drill it?
Did they get the phase one? So no.
So you don't know if it's contamination.
So they're going off of historical records. So there's a remedial action that's been put into place that's logged in the state of Alaska. That is what they look at.
My question is, if you know there's pollution next to a piece of property, why aren't we drilling it? Why are we loaning money on a piece of property when we know there's water pollution of a fire already that's next door?
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't we want to make sure that the property is not polluted otherwise or even water pollution?
In this case, we rely on environmental professionals and engineers that go in there and ascertain whether or not the additional action would be needed. So they look at the historical records and indicate that there is no need on this particular property to do it, especially when there's known issues in the area. Anchorage itself has many known issues below properties where there's extensive remedial action that's taken place, but there's known issues.
But we don't know. That's what I'm getting at. You don't know what issues are actually there. You know that there's mm-hmm. water pollution theoretically next door,
mm-hmm.
but you don't know what's on this piece of property. And again, I'm going to put everybody's attention to the PFAS issue at Anchorage International Airport.
Mm-hmm.
This is new.
Mm-hmm.
We're now there, deadlocked, two blocks. They can't even disturb the ground anymore out there
mm-hmm.
until they find a solution, which is they're trying to work with DEC and EPA to figure out what to do, because the EPA made it a pollutant,
mm-hmm.
right? But it doesn't affect the groundwater, even though it's in it, because there's water and sewer, but mm-hmm. you can't do anything with it.
Right.
You can't develop a piece of property. So, again, the question on that from a policy standpoint,
mm-hmm.
not thinking on this piece of property, if you know there's pollutants next door,
mm-hmm.
why would we rely on a phase one? To me, that doesn't, I have no comfort level on phase one unless you actually look.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
So I have some questions. So the property next door,
mm-hmm.
what kind of environmental study did they determine that there was a problem with the groundwater? Phase one, phase two, phase three, what did they use?
We'd have to do research on that particular property, and with the groundwater contamination, they would have needed to do a phase two in order to ascertain that actually was the case. and then there was remediation that happened. This was the Fairbanks Fire Training Facility, so they were well aware that and that this could be an issue. When it was hooked up to city water in 1990, they deemed it no longer an issue because they're not drilling for a well or anything.
So they're not using water, but that doesn't mean it still affects this property. Why wouldn't we use the same environmental study to determine if there's problems there that they used to determine there was problems on that property?
They're commissioned by the borrower and the lender, so they're private. We would not have access to that. They would have to order a phase two on their own, which typically...
Well, that wasn't my question. Why wouldn't we use the same phase two that was used?
Why wouldn't we require that?
Yeah, the same phase.
85% of the risk, why wouldn't we require it?
That, well, this is where, with the process of the program, it's the underwriting is at the bank level. The bank is determined in their underwriting that they're basing on the phase one. Doesn't preclude you as the board in the review and approval, if it is a subsequent approval of this, to have alternative requirements. But this is the way that it was presented ultimately to us, and that was the determination of the underwriting bank.
Okay, so we're taking 85% of the risk. I'm not, Debbie Downer here, whatever you want to call it. we have known pollution, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Bill can tell you a horror story, but I can tell you a horror story that we, property in Fairbanks, were half a mile away. The property that we had was polluted by a fuel terminal that was there back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And the diesel fuel got in the groundwater, and it came through, you know, half a mile away to our property. And, of course, when we went to sell it, and the buyer went to do the deal, they punched the holes, and guess what? You know, it was a nightmare. So here we already know there's something next door.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's on it. We're taking 85% of risk. From a policy standpoint, I don't know if we should do that or not. That's my question. So, Kevin?
Mr. Chair, I just had a quick question. Is the contaminant included in the process of determining the value? So when they determined the value, did they assume the contaminant was on the property since it was next door and there hasn't been a test done? Because that would be a big difference to me, I guess. And this
I mean, there's already one.
Yeah, well, I would assume that's
more. Everything, a lot of tables, 4 to 8 feet in Fairbanks, and it goes all over the place.
That's true. I would assume this contaminant, because of the location of the training facility and the adjacent property having that contaminant and it being a well-known issue. And so, as a well-known and disclosed issue, I would assume it went into the valuation. If it didn't, then that would be a concern if it had a potential to negatively impact the valuation of the property.
Well, yeah.
What was the contaminant?
It's the resultant of PFCs in the groundwater.
It's a fire retardant that they use, foaming agents. It's called PFAS.
Okay.
And it's considered hazardous to the environment.
What concerns me is the liability. Does the applicant know that if 50 years from now there's a big problem? Everybody that was on title is liable. I don't care if you sold the property and 20 years ago. If they find a problem, they trace it back, and everybody who was on that chain of title is liable. Is the applicant aware of that?
We don't speak directly with the applicant typically at this stage, so we have to communicate with the lender.
So we had to hire the DEC to track back where the actual solution started from to get us off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
That costs a lot of money on the property in Fairbanks to do that. We ultimately, you know, 2 years and I'll say north of 6 figures later, we figured out, because nothing was there. And then come find out we're spending money to drill our way to find the source. We found the source. The moral of the story here is that we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so here we do know there's something. We're 85% of the risk. To me, we should be being a little more proactive to cover our risk on that. Bill?
So, I mean, this is a very well-known issue in Fairbanks. It travels miles, this PFAS from city turbines to accepted responsibility. They put in utilities in an area where there weren't utilities. It goes from, this is on 30th Avenue all the way over to West Fred's. It covers, you know, several square miles. I'm assuming the appraiser, it certainly isn't affecting the cash flow of the property. I don't think it affects the marketability. I would guess that the appraisers, any appraiser that knows a lot of work in the Fairbanks market would know that this is...
It's a well-known issue.
It is quite a well-known issue. So it's not, by no means, just this small area. It's
What does that mean? You got migrating water bringing stuff into the property, this being one of them, but you don't know what else is doing it. And then my next question is going to be, is there a fuel tank on the property?
Has there been a fuel tank? Let me look, because I believe it is a gas fire boiler.
Huh? No, but natural gas was existed 5 years ago.
So if there's an existing fuel tank on the property, I have to look back into the file. I believe right now it is gas, but whether or not it was a legacy fuel tank, I'm not sure, on the property. Right. And I'm not sure if it was below ground or above ground when it's been removed, but there's nothing now.
It's contaminated, right? So you'd think that the other thing you do with Fairbanks is that they haven't taken the tank out, mitigated it and cleaned it and got approval. You want to make sure that do some testing around it, make sure it doesn't leak.
Chairman, Alan Weiser, you had asked the question of what our policy is, or had, you know, made a comment towards that. Our policy has been to work with the underwriting bank, the originating bank, with their customer, and what they have ultimately initiated, required environmental report-wise, that they know they're undertaking. The borrower, in this case, knows that it's been this phase one assessment that's been done. And then the way that ultimately with the valuation comes through, that's what we work with as a policy. We have not adopted a policy that independently requires X condition of a phase one, phase two, whatever the case would be, environmental report.
Yeah. Well, again, they're out 15 years. We're out of 25, which means the building's going to be 60-some years old. So we're laying on, you know, building that when it gets done, it'll be 60-some years old. Who knows what kind of, you know, in 60-some years what it's probably going to be worth. But that being said, I'm going back to the phase one versus the phase two property next door having, you know, this being detailed out, you know, that we haven't, that should be a red flag. A buried fuel tank should be a red flag. Is it a 500-gallon one for a furnace? Is it 1,000? Is it where there was a, you know, construction company there that had diesel in there for their equipment? You know, I mean, there's just a whole bunch of reasons back in the day why you want to change this or check this out, as far as I'm concerned. So to me, it's a challenge. I think it's pretty risky by you know, being 85% of the risk, 25 years, and not knowing what's under the ground. That's my opinion. Knowing that next door is contaminated and knowing that Fairbanks water moves around.
Well, I think your comments, Chair.
I don't worry about it.
One of the things I would bring up is if the property had been historically used for something high risk, like you were talking about, construction or diesel, that is exactly what the phase one looks at, is historical records, historical use of the property. One of the issues that will come up with an asphalted property with no known leak, something that cannot be seen, is where would they sample for the phase two? It would be really random, right, without having any idea of where to go. Right, so that would be one of the things that would be a problem that I've often heard with doing a phase two on asphalt with known leaks. And it's not unusual to see a property next door in Alaska, even in Anchorage or in Mattsu, where there has been issues in the past that have been remediated. But we typically, in the private sector and here at ADA, have relied upon the environmental engineer letting us know whether or not the further action would be required.
Someone orders the phase one. The engineer doesn't decide it's the phase two or three.
Can I ask a question?
The borrower does.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Julie.
So when a bank is doing a loan like this in to the private sector, is this a conversation that they are having in terms of phase one, phase two, or is phase one adequate for them to move forward on lending?
When is the environmental engineer has issued a no additional action needed, that requires no phase two. Correct. No additional action is needed in this case.
Okay, thank you.
You know, I think I think it's a challenge. I want to make the loan. I think it's good, but I just have a challenge not knowing what's going on the ground there.
And
well, I'd like to hear from the rest of the board members. Okay. You know, it's risk, right? You know, I've got a lot of phase ones done before, and you basically, you hire them, you tell them, we'll look around and see, and they have no idea what's underneath the ground.
Mm-hmm. No, they do a little digging.
The property owner owns the field. Now, we did this in Kodiak on a hotel, I believe. There was a fuel tank,
yeah.
And we made them go back,
yeah.
And we approved the loan subject to a clean phase two, where they actually went around because of the big fuel tank there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead.
So are you suggesting that any real estate acquisition or loan would be subject to phase two environmental review, or is it just because this has this known hazard, which, as we've talked about, isn't really, it's not a hydrocarbon issue, it's a water quality issue that makes it unusable for drinking water. You can still use it to wash your clothes because the industry has this problem. And they have the state and responsibility in that instance. They bring drinking water to Gustavus and distribute it. The residents use the water for washing clothes, doing other chores that you need water for. So again, I don't, unless you were going to make it the policy for everybody, I don't know that it necessarily is applicable to just this property because of this particular contamination.
I think it's two things. One, that there's a known contaminant, and to understand it, because it could go up later, so a baseline, what it is, parts per million, that's number one. Number two is that there's a tank, fuel tank there. Once you look at that, because that's hydrocarbons, completely different. You know, government is completely different than private. From experience, I can tell you that I've done a lot of work in Whittier. Second bucket went to the ground. The guys had to come out of a 40-hour haz whopper. State said put it right back in the ground. That was a private piece of property. The owner would have been broke in a week. It smelled so bad. So it depends on who the owner is and who makes the rules and regulation. But we're ultimately responsible for a loan, and the fiduciary responsibility to be prudent about it. So I think from my perspective and historical knowledge, unfortunately maybe too much about the Fairbanks area, that I know the groundwater moves things around. And I've been unpleasantly surprised before. We have a known one issue. That tells me water is moving back and forth. I'm not blaming this piece of property. I just want to make sure we do our due diligence to make sure that we manage the risk for the people's money. And that's each piece of property stands on its own, I think. So that's my
opinion. And it's a liability, of course. If it travels to that property, goes to the next property, somebody gets in that property and says, well, if you would have stopped it going through your property, and then they're tied up in litigation.
Again, it's a fuel tank. Let's say it's leaking, right, or leak, and it's going to someone else's property. Right? But at the end of the day, if it's a 500-gallon tank or a 1,000-gallon tank for a furnace, and it's leaked on there, well, that could be pretty easy to clean up right now versus waiting. Again, not knowing. And we're not setting precedents here if we require a phase two based on a fuel tank. But there's a double whammy. We already know the water's contaminated from drinking standpoint. I would assume that the appraisal took into account if it's prevalent to the Fairbanks, the drinking water. Would you think, Bill?
Yeah.
I would assume that. Yeah.
All I would highlight again in the discussion is that it's you're talking about conditions which could happen that you're concerned. It's not known elements or about the property.
Well, we have to react to this particular one. There's a policy that you guys should think about. I'm not trying this policy here in today's board meeting about future pieces of property and triggers that causes more due diligence, maybe. My opinion here is you should establish a baseline before you lend the money. Okay? My opinion. So, I'm up to whatever the board says.
I'd like to make a motion that we make it a condition of a phase two environmental.
This is Albert. I'll second.
I was just questioning, what are we looking for? I mean, you know, what's success in the phase two? I mean, we know it's there, so. Things in addition to the known contaminant of PFAS.
So, I don't test for hydrocarbons and arsenic and stuff like that. It's not a big deal. They, you know, they'll probably shoot four holes.
May I ask the questions for clarification on how we're supposed to approach something? Because PFAS is prevalent within Fairbanks. Are we now making a decision, or is that direction ultimately to aid a staff that for any Fairbanks City and North Pole property that we're looking at, we are requiring a phase two?
So you're jumping to conclusions.
Right.
We're talking about this piece of property.
Okay.
I suggested that you guys work up a proposed policy to manage the risk wherever we're at in the city.
There was a known problem.
Yeah.
Phase two done on an adjacent property.
You know, again, yeah, known problem. Buried fuel tanks. You know, gas station next door. Historical information. Just, you know, just any red flags. That may cause additional reconnaissance, and it may not even require a phase two, you know. But here we did the Kodiak with less. Go ahead, Julie.
I'm following the train of thought on how the staff move forward, because it does set a precedent, and so in my mind it's. I'm a process person, so I understand all the reasons why the folks with experience, especially in construction or personal investment, have challenges with this, but as I understand it, this is a process that a private investment company would take, and there's not a reason indicated to stop the movement of the loan. So in my mind, I mean, I would totally feel comfortable. I mean, I understand the risk, Dana, and I totally agree with you. There is risk. But I also see from staff's point of view, especially in this area, why they would need direction in terms of how to move forward. So do they peel apart each one of these in terms of potential environmental risk? Or are we satisfied with the initial engineer's report? And in my mind, I'm satisfied with the initial engineer's report and take the staff recommendation, and I feel comfortable with that.
Yeah, I think with the combination of a fuel tank and a known issue and the engineer says, oh, it's all good, I'm not buying it. I'll just put it real blunt.
So moving forward then, are we saying that with any fuel tank, are you saying that you want to peel apart all of these environmental ones on a case by case?
So, again, I'm looking for staff to come up with a risk management policy. I'm focused on
this resolution that's in front of us today and this loan and putting possible contingency on subject to a successful phase two environmental analysis that is acceptable to staff, just like we didn't go yet.
I heard the staff say this, that they felt like the phase one was acceptable to them. Did I not hear that right?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Well, you know, speaking from the staff side of that, Commissioner Sandy, that is correct. That was our view based upon the analysis that was given to us by the underwriting bank and ultimately knowing the process that they would have undertaken with the borrower in this case. And it all, and really trying to do it also is just to find, when you talk about our current policy, is to work with the underwriting banks on this particular issue. How it's handled in very specific circumstances, Chair, you're correct in identifying the fact that with the Kodiak property and the discussion at that point in time, that was a supplemental requirement ultimately leading to approval for taking the participation.
As a point of clarification, we are unaware if it was an above-ground or below-ground fuel tank. If it was not a below-ground fuel tank and it was above-ground and removed, that would inherently not be a risk then, correct?
That was my point, Mr. Chair. If potentially Bill would consider amending his motion the PFC issue, I think, is one issue, and I think at least I'm pretty comfortable with the PFC issue, that there's a known problem, there's a bloom, it comes from a public source, they've mitigated by providing drinking water to the property. If there's a buried, unmitigated oil tank on the property, then I think the concerns that you've outlined come to the fore, and that I think everybody would agree it warrants additional work be done from an environmental perspective. But if there, in fact, was either an above-ground tank that was removed or a below-ground tank that was mitigated, then there maybe isn't as much of a need for a additional environmental analysis of this property. And again, unless you're going to do it on all properties, because every property could have something coming from half a mile away.
The motion wasn't for all properties. The motion was for this property.
And that's what I was discussing, is why this property could potentially require additional environmental review or be a standard for every property that's environmental review.
My reasoning was because the adjacent property had a phase two and found problems.
I believe it was just the PFCs next door, or was there something else?
Right. He's asking, is it a general indication that they would have a phase two to ascertain that there was that contamination? Possibly, yes. But again, right, that if the borrower owns these reports, it wouldn't be something that we would be privy to. So I am assuming, based upon what they have reported on contamination, that they did drill. But I would not know that. It's just like an appraisal that's owned by the borrower and it's private.
So again, it just sounds like we're moving towards additional regulation on any or borrower requirement that the underwriting community is not currently requiring. If any parcel that has the theoretical potential of contaminants, not based on anything that we know about that property, but just because groundwater moves, that's going to be every property.
So our risk is more on refinance. This is a refinance. Right? So new construction, typically not an issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
But on a refinance, that's a 35-year-old building, so if you want to set up a policy, it's a refinance, flag number one. Number two, if there's any known pollutants around it, regardless of what it is, flag number three. Flag number three would be if there's a buried fuel tank there. Flag number three, I mean, ultimately, you know, to me, it's to manage at risk what kind of policies you put in place. And so I don't want to set it today. I think this is a good loan. I think we should put the covenant on there, though, that's subject to a successful phase two, to protect the people's money. That's where I'm coming. Because I see three flags without even looking at it. Again, a legacy building in Fairbanks. And maybe the fourth flag is just unfortunate historical knowledge.
Which, I think maybe that's the first flag.
Yeah. Well, again, You always pay for your education, right? So that's why. And so, Bill, your amendment is appreciated to do it, but we have to put the resolution on the floor first, and then you can make the decision.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Albert. So, is there anything else that, on that?
I think we've discussed the pertinent information on.
I have one last question, and that is it, it's a, what do we have a policy? And it's just this one brought up, and I'm not pointing on this one. When we do refinancing and the buildings become over like 50 years old, at, you know, the term of the loan is past 50 years, is there some, do you guys consider how long the term of the new loan will be? Is there a structure or something that, so if it's going to be a 75-year-old building, we'll only do a 20-year loan, or?
We have statutes and regulations that define the extent, the term of our loan. It can go out to a maximum of 25 years, but is subject to the usable life of the underlying facility, and that's within the appraisal that is defined.
It's 75% of the remaining estimated economic life. This also has accelerated amortization, so it will pay off in 23 years.
Okay. Again, I just asked the question because I put the two numbers together and said, okay, what's the deal?
And that applies for equipment as well.
Yeah. No, that's fine. All right, so I will
stick to motion for you. I move resolution number L22-01.
I second.
And
is there any modifications to it?
And then I'd like to move that the approval of the loan is conditioned on a successful phase two environmental.
This is Albert. I'll second that motion.
So further clarification, that successful phase two will be solely determined by staff. Does that come back to the board? And we'll have to vote on modifying the resolution first. Okay. So, Randy.
Miss Sandy. Yes.
Well, I want our vote known, but yes.
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 Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Yes. That motion passes to modify the resolution. Before us now is the modified resolution 22-01. That's up for the vote. Any further discussion? Would you pull the board, please?
Mr. Sandy?
Yeah.
Mr. Mitchell?
Yes.
Mr. Sandy?
Yes.
Mr. Clayton?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Beavermore?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. That brings us up to resolution G22-06. Chair,
go ahead.
I was just going to read it into the record.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's the Ambler Mining District Transportation Corridor Technical Feasibility Study. Alan?
Chair, before the board is resolution number G2206, which is a resolution of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority relating to development of the Ambler Access Project to conduct technical feasibility studies of the Ambler Access Corridor and proposed Tidewater export terminals. So attached to the resolution is a memorandum that was prepared by staff, ultimately, making a proposal at this point in time for us to allocate $250,000 to undertake advanced technical and feasibility studies of the logistics for development of the Ambler Mining District. So within the memorandum, which again was attached to the resolution available for the public, we're defining what purpose we're looking for ultimately with the $250,000 if it gets allocated. This would be undertaken in a competitive bid process for parties that are capable of initiating the technical feasibility and functional study with us. is for understanding what roadblocks or logistics chain that's involved for the full development of the Amber Mining District. And in order to take that a step back, I would highlight ADA has, through its resolutions approved by the board, in developing the Ambler Access Project, which is one element of this corridor, ultimately for the development and feasibility of mineral development within Ambler Mining District. The way that we have looked at it, with the access provided by the Ambler Access Project to the mining district, again, as codified under ANILCA initially and as pursued by us in current development approved under records of decision by the Bureau of Land Management and National Park Service, a joint records of decision in that case. The mineral district itself is a key source of strategic and critical minerals for the U.S. It is a secure domestic supply of that mineral base. It's abundant in copper, which is not currently defined as a strategic or critical mineral, but is critical in the transition to the new economy, a tech-focused economy. By current estimates, with the number of EVs that are currently under production and anticipated by the year 2035, as well as further electrification within our economy, you're looking at a requirement for at least 100% more current supply of copper than currently mined in this case. The Ambler Mining District itself is an abundant resource of copper, but it also is the U.S.'s sole identified resource of cobalt for battery manufacturing, for electric vehicles, and other uses. It's also a source of germanium and gallium, which are utilized in every element of solar conducting capacity, as well as with solar panels directly, again, elements of our new technology. So with that and the access that's available within Ambler Mining District, we look at it on the level of having, at some point, the full development of those mines, four to five red dogs in operation. And what we've seen with Red Dog itself, with ADA's development and working with NANA and Tech, and that was with the road and port facilities that enabled, this over time, through Tech and NANA's investment, created the number two supplier of zinc globally, and is continuing to grow in that capacity. So they employ a level of about 600 people. They're native Alaskans, representing approximately 55% of the employee base, NANA shareholders that are directly involved. It's directly benefited the local communities and economy there within Kotzebue and the Northwest Arctic Borough. And of the total 600 that get seasonally and annually employed within the mining development of Red Dog, we know that well over 90% are Alaskans that work in these mines. So with the development of the Ambler Mining District and ensuring that there's a corridor in place, we are facilitating significant job growth within the state and significant benefits ultimately in diversifying our economy with the mineral content, the safe, secure resource ultimately for the U.S. Specifically to what we're looking to do, I've asked Jesse Peterson to join. He's going to be the project manager if this is approved ultimately and undertaking the study. And Jesse, if you would please give a summary of the process that we're going to take in the competitive bid process and then what we're asking them through scope to undertake.
So yes. Before we do that, Warren, the rationale why we're doing it.
Absolutely, Chair. Attached with the memorandum is a map which we're using a courtesy of Ambler Metals, which is the developer of the Arctic mine. What we're trying to identify the fact is when a lot of the conversation has been on ADA's development of the Ambler Access Project. However, this graph itself, or picture itself, which again attached to the memorandum shows, is that the Ambler Access Project, while 211 miles, is a small component of the logistics chain required ultimately to get the ore concentrate to a port of exit. And then the question ultimately comes with bottlenecks that are inevitable within the current infrastructure chain to get to a port of exit. Where are the bottlenecks concentrated? Where are the best investments to relieve those bottlenecks? And then really define what port is ultimately the best to be developed to really facilitate the full development of the Ambler Mining District. There's been separate analysis done of Port McKenzie in some context. There's been analysis done of the Port of Anchorage, Whittier, Seward. We're looking to bring all this together with the focus specifically on the ore concentrate volume that we anticipate coming from the Amber Mining District once the access is made available.
So if I could just add to the board, especially if you more than that. So everybody's been focused on the Amber Road. It's a 211-mile road. And Dave, what's your best guesstimate for how much it's going to cost today before inflation? $700 million now. Okay. So what's $500 worth? $700, depending on, you know. Obviously, it'll be a toll road and paid by the mines, correct? Problem is though, I call it the last mile. It's kind of a communication fiber optic term. Is all this stuff that comes in two trailers into the Dalton Highway, they drop it down to one trailer, highway trucks, brings it to the Fairbanks, it goes on a railroad, brings it to Anchorage, and we all know the Port of Anchorage, there's no way it can handle five mines and all this ore concentrate coming in. So would we spend $700 million to have a bottleneck the last 30 miles in Anchorage? That, you know, so with Alan's and staff's credit, with my prodding a little bit, is what are we going to do about the last mile? I mean, why would we spend $700 million or $500 million or a dollar without addressing the whole transportation system? And I think this is the start to understand that. Now, it will obviously be interesting to see, you know, Port of Anchorage, Port of, you know, Maxie Port, Seward, Whittier. I mean, there's all sorts of different plans. There may even be, in my estimation, there may be even some money spent on the Dalton Highway so that you can actually bring the doubles, you know, take some curves out, bring doubles all the way down to Fairbanks or goes on the rail. That may be a possibility. So holistically, we need to look at the whole thing in order to make sure that $700 million we spend, or whatever number that is, and our customer, being the mining company, that they're going to pay us back, that they're not too blocked. And that this is the start of that. So I just wanted to, board members, kind of get around about that. I would hope that we can run doubles all the way down the Fairbanks, put it on the rail, and then go into a, you know, into a designated upland of thousands of acres, and we can handle any natural resource that comes into the South Central Alaska. But that's wishful thinking again.
Chair, if I may give some context, we've been defining it, and all the numbers that have been on the cost of the Ambler Access Project development has been in the range of $500 to $559 million. And as you've pointed out several times as we've been reviewing the different budgets and establishments, that is based on 2018, 2019 dollars.
Yeah.
So with inflation, it's going to impact that investment number. And at this stage, it's preliminary. We don't know what the full analysis is. It's really relying upon our being able to undertake the design and the work that we have anticipated and planned on doing with this field season and advancing those numbers.
So there's lots of advantage to be the first person in the Amber Metals, and I'll just say this on the record. They're first in. They could probably have just the Port of Anchorage. It's mine 2, 3, 4, and 5. They'll have a problem. It won't be, so the injectional road will be underutilized because of it, because they have no place to go. So we need to solve this problem holistically with the, you know, with the entire transportation. So I appreciate this, and I look forward to Jesse telling us, you know, how they're going to do it. But for the board to understand why we're doing this, we've got to look at it from a big picture.
Chair, as you've highlighted in several discussions, is that we see our role with the Amber Access Project and with this study of really being able to implement ways of facilitating the development of the Amber Mining District as quickly as possible. And most importantly, as you've highlighted, not leaving it into the hands of the individual mine, their exploration, to having undertake to solve problems that are infrastructure issues within the state.
Yeah, certainly. Well, Dana, you explained it pretty good, the reasoning behind why we need to pursue this technical feasibility study. And so what we're going to propose is that we competitively procure a third-party contractor, an engineering contractor, to help us understand the technical components of each different port that's connected via rail and how they can accommodate ore coming from the Amber Mining District. And so the way we're looking at doing that is to have a comparative analysis between all the ports that are connected via rail, go through a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And then we'd also like to get an idea of what the potential investment would be in those ports. And so we're asking for a Class 5 estimate, which is consistent with a conceptual level of design, just to get an idea of which ports, if there's a port that has particular strengths, but the investment is X, we want to know what that looks like versus the other ports. And so we'll put this out to bid and procure a contractor here and get underway with the work. So,
but Jesse, would it be part of, or can you work with DOT and at least get their opinion on the Dalton part about being able to stay, you know, maybe with a highway tractor, but be able to continue with two trailers coming down?
Yeah, certainly. We need to work with the DOT and with Alaska Railroad to fully understand the constraints on the whole logistics chain, because that will affect the vessels coming into whichever port. So,
Randy?
Thank you, Chair. I'm relatively new, so I don't know the process that the board and staff went through for this, but for my point of reference, could you share with me the distance from the mine site to the tidewater west of the site?
So it's 201 miles from the mining district to the Dalton. And I think we got a pretty good diagram right here.
I saw that. I just couldn't tell how far that was.
About 900 miles.
261, so that's about 400. About 800 miles.
From the mine west.
Yes. Oh, from the mine west. Oh, I'm sorry.
Mine west.
West.
The tidewater.
Oh, you're talking about the canal.
Right.
Yeah.
West.
That's a couple hundred miles.
About yeah, when I'm looking at a map, it's a couple hundred miles.
Through the chair, former Mayor, what I would highlight is that you're asking a question which is covered very specifically within the joint record of decision. And that's under sections, I believe it's references 1.5, but I know it's also referenced in Appendix G. There have been significant studies undertaken looking at routes that are from the mining district going west, either Kotzebue and also going southwest, actually down to Nome. About 13 different proposals have been put in place that were initially evaluated in some aspects by Department of Transportation, but then fully reviewed with the Bureau of Land Management. So the designation for milepost 161 on the Dalton Highway going from east to west to the mining district complies with ANILCA and for definitive subsistence issues is the best route, ultimately.
Alan, I wasn't specifically asking about the process. I just wanted for my own edification to know whether it's about midstream, and I say midstream from Dalton to Ambler and Ambler on to Tidewater West, due west. So now that I have that frame of reference, I know that you and your staff have done excellent due diligence on selecting this road. Thank you.
So Randy, there was actually two or three routes on the road, and I think DLM selected the final route. Is that correct?
That is correct. And Appendix G gives all the detail of all the varied routes that have been analyzed by, again, originally the Department of Transportation, and then subsequently with consultation with all stakeholders about different routes. This is the best viable route, ultimately, for all purposes of development.
There's a green button here somewhere.
I just leave my arm.
Well, I growl every now and then, so. Thank you, Alan. I understand more now than I did.
this is the just for the board, this is the first step that we're taking in this type of analysis. This was not part of the Antler Access project because that focused on the road development itself. This is something that we are separately looking at undertaking for a study specifically related to the Antler Mining District and other development that will come. What I am anticipating is based upon the feedback we get from whatever consultant is ultimately retained through the competitive bid process and a final report, we will be updating the board at that point in time with follow-on recommendations as far as if there's initial information or there, at that point in time, is a identification of a clear bottleneck that needs to be addressed, in which case we would look to put together a plan on how ADA could be proactive on that specific issue.
Oh, not yet. I was going to ask Jesse. So, Jesse, there's a huge movement right now, at least the administration in Anchorage, the borough, or the municipality, that there's perceived deficiency, which is just like that's for Anchorage, and there's big cuts to fix it. So the big bus is going to, you know, they're looking for dollars to do this. Will that play into this, kind of dovetail into this analysis that what ultimately the city spends to fix the port? And the reason why I say that is because the port is landlocked, right? It can't expand anymore unless you fill in the tidewater, which is, you know, super expensive and a whole myriad of problems. And so they're going to spend, I don't know, some people say $1 billion, but $500 million, $800 million on a port that actually cannot, but they're going to want, obviously, revenue from something like this, and they may be even anticipating some of the revenue from something like this, you know, pay for those upgrades. So is there going to be, if you can tell me, any constraints or directions put on a consultant on what to consider to keep apples and apples instead of apples and oranges, i.e., if there's 5 mining districts, how much uplands, storage that you need, you know, you gotta have, you know, you just can't be a poster, you know, 10 acres, it's gotta be X and off, it's gotta be accessed year round by, you know, ships, you know, just some sort of constraints on that.
Yeah, we're gonna bracket the analysis with those types of constraints, and so there's, you know, one that comes to mind right away is, you know, is there a capacity to store the containers for the backhaul going north, and so that's something we need to understand based on the volumes that we're anticipating coming off of one line. Now you extrapolate that to multiple lines operating concurrently at the same time, then we'll have an idea of what type of laydown area we're looking at. But we certainly need to bracket and put some definition in the criteria to make sure we are comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges.
So does that mean that the methodology that they transport the ore, the first mine is that all the other mines are going to have to follow the same suit, i.e. the double, the trailers with the boxes? Or will this anticipate another mine may have a whole different way of transporting the ore instead of moving boxes? They may, you know, some other type of container or just a trailer itself, open container.
Chair, if I may sound wise, sir, that what you're asking is a very key question, because the additional, you know, the analysis that's been done on the road has made a general assumption of what the mining development would be. We know that Antler Mine, or sorry, the Arctic Mine and Antler Metals and their development of it are currently looking at how they're going to be transporting their ore concentrates. So it gets to ultimately the question about the operation of the road itself. So I see this as us being able to really define operating procedures on the road that maximize the full development of the mining district itself. It's a question that we are going to have to identify, because that is where you define ultimately what standards and issues you're identifying or defining within that to the consultant that defines out and identifies the bottlenecks. So it's a critical question that we ourselves need to see if there is a standard that has to be applied across the different mining development for it to maximize the current infrastructure, limit further investment, ultimately, that's required in different areas, and facilitate lower costs for everyone who's ultimately developing within the mining district.
So would you explain to me the, what they mean by ore concentrate? Is that just going through like a ball mill or a crusher, and then it's brought in? Is there any sort of separation at the mine itself?
So it's milled at the mine, and what's transported is the finished product that goes to the smelter. So that's what it is. So it's the raw concentrate that gets transported to a different location to where it gets smelted into a usable product.
So it's separated out. Copper, if you load the copper, load the silver, gold.
Correct. No. Yeah. If there's that much gold going out in trucks, then that's
the
it would be.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to, you know, write shotgun on that one out.
Yep.
So
anything else?
No, I think we covered it all there, Dan.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. We have to do it. I mean, we have to understand the whole transportation thing, so I'm a big supporter. Any questions on the resolution? I'll look for a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to motion resolution number G22-06, the resolution of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority relating to development of the Ambler Access Project to conduct technical feasibility studies of the Ambler Access Corridor and proposed tidewater export terminals.
This is Bill Kennedy, my second.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Albert. Further discussion?
Should we consider tidewater export terminals in southeast for further clarity? Alan, do you have an opinion?
Through the chair, board member Ellis, within the memorandum, we really define four specific ports that we're talking about.
Okay.
So that's the port of Port McKenzie, Port of Anchorage, Seward, and Whittier. Those are what we're concentrating. If you want to expand it beyond that, we can certainly do that, but those are the four we've concentrated on.
I think those four are sufficient. Thank you.
Further discussion? Hearing none, Ben, would you call the board, please?
Commissioner
Sandy?
Yes.
Mr. Kennedy?
Yes.
Mr. Kennedy?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis?
Yes.
Mr. Yes. Checkers?
Yes.
Thank you. So motion passes. The summer work plan? Do you want to do it now or do you want to do it in the board comments? Okay. All right. So now item number D is executive session related to litigation update by Department of Law involving attorney-client privileges, matters related to the Castor versus AEA and ADA, and confidential deliberate matters related to the assets owned by Mustang Holdings, LLC. I will entertain a motion going to executive session.
I move that the board enter an executive session to discuss ongoing litigation with the Department of Law involving attorney-client privilege matters related to the Kastner versus AEA and ADA, and confidential financial matters related to the assets owned by Mustang Holdings, LLC. This is supported by the Open Meetings Act, Alaska Statute 44-62-310, which allows the board to consider the attorney-client privilege information and confidential matters in executive session. The discussions of these subjects would have an adverse effect on the finances of ADA and are protected by law.
Is there a second?
This is Albert. I'll second.
Any objection? We're going to executive session. And hearing none, we will go into executive session and take a 5-minute break. Sure.
Here you are on the record.
Thank you. Well, I'll advise the board that I take any action on the matters discussed while executive sessions were other than provided instructional to the council.
That brings us up to item number 7, director's comments. That would be you, Alan.
Thank you, Chairman. To the board, what we have first off under 7A on the agenda, we have an update to the recent resolution that was approved by the board for allocating $150,000 for some due diligence efforts on a land development work that we have within the Fairbanks North Star Borough. So we do have a presentation that was attached to the agenda, so the public should also have that available. And just ask if Rainey, if you're able to bring it up, please.
You going to make this presentation on Friday, for Thursday, tomorrow?
It will be a small portion of that. We're talking broader with AGC about development in general within the state.
Well, it'd be good. It's in Fairbanks, and so they'd like to hear.
Absolutely. We had a piece of that.
Just trying to help them up there.
So this is, again, follow-up on the due diligence efforts we're looking at for the partnership with the City of North Pole. Initiated ultimately with discussions over in December, which, Chair, you were certainly part of. And really working also on a highlight with Bill Bibblemore, our Fairbanks representative on the board. So what we looking at on page 2 of the presentation, really what we're highlighting here with the facility zone land development, that it's really looking at continuing to support the military's presence in the state of Alaska, noting the global tragedy that's happening within Ukraine created by Russia's invasion. It only highlights ultimately the importance of Alaska in the U.S.'s military mission, our presence logistically, and how that is looking at addressing some of those concerns that are being raised in the way that our military mission here is prepared to address those issues and expanding with the support of our delegation. So the land development itself is looking to create the vehicle for housing unit construction that would create opportunities for military personnel to live within the Fairbanks North Star rural communities, either City of North Pole or Fairbanks itself. So the it's really based upon the strategic positioning itself within Alaska on the Arctic and also the Indo-Pacific Asian mission that is present there. It is the expansion ultimately of infrastructure within the city limits itself within the City of North Pole. So it advances ultimately ADA's mission in infrastructure development. And it's ultimately leading to with home bedding of the different military units, their personnel being off base, they're within the communities, there's those broader benefits ultimately come to the community. Those are the principal drivers that have been behind us looking at in the military facility zone land development. Now, with that being said, what I'll highlight is that under the project structure, and this is slide 3 of the presentation, is that we're working under our statutes 4488-172, in particular, A, which authorizes ADA to own and invest in public use facilities. Excuse me. So, in effect, that's projects with a public purpose. And this includes infrastructure for an area that is designated as a military facility zone. And this follows through under our definitions of a project under 4488-172, which is, in itself, statutes 4488-900, specifically 13I, which allows ADA to invest in infrastructure as long as that investment is within a military facility zone within the state of Alaska. Military facility zones are designated under specifically in Alaska statutes. They're authorized by the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, and as it currently exists, there is one military facility zone within the state of Alaska, and that is the City of North Pole. Obviously in support of Alaska Air Force Base and in some part Fort Wainwright. The structure that has been brought together in working with the City of North Pole and also input from ADA and ADA's board members is a public-private partnership with the City of North Pole. And in this case, we're looking to really initiate between 100 to 150 units, possibly more, within the environs of the City of North Pole. And that is the area and feedback from the military command that we understand is the preference area for personnel that are allocated to Eielson Air Force Base, obviously because of the proximity to the Air Force Base itself. It's a partnership with the City of North Pole, and that is the facilitates the public interest and public purpose part of it. And very recently, there was a resolution that was passed, voted 7-0 to the resolution, supporting the City of North Pole's engagement with ADA on this project development. So the City of North Pole itself would acquire the land. They would transfer that ultimately to ADA. ADA would be responsible for investments ultimately in the infrastructure and the master planning development for the housing units themselves. We would allocate land, lots, different platting that would be available for multiple housing contractors. We're looking to incorporate as many participants as possible within the Fairbanks North Star Borough community. We are also looking at engaging with construction finance from multiple lenders. We're trying to establish a platform that works universally for land development, and then also working with Alaska Housing Finance for the takeout of that financing facility. So all in all, it's bringing a lot of many different stakeholders within the Fairbanks North Star Borough together with the principal focus of initiating this land development and having it available for housing units by 2023.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead,
Alan, thank you very much for the presentation. Are we also working with the interior gas unit to bring natural gas to this development?
Through the chair, Member Fogle, yes, we are. We have contacted IGU and are in discussions about how heating, in this case specifically gas connections, can be brought to the community. On this next slide, I'd like to identify the property that we're focused on the most. And actually, I also would like to invite Angela Keith to join me. If you would talk a little bit about the connections that are in place, and that can, in part, Board Member Fogle would address your question on IGU.
Is my microphone on? Yes, thank you, Director Weissner. I did meet with IGU on March 16th, and gas is in close proximity to this property and relatively low cost. So I was pleased.
Before the Randy doesn't know about this, but the interior gas unit and how we helped develop that and brought it to the North Slope.
Certainly,
background for them.
I can give some background. So with Senate Bill 23, which was passed in 2013, that was establishing effectively an intent of creating a gas utility within the interior to supply gas, was ultimately to address different emissions issues that were occurring within the community. ADA was designated funding through our Sustainable Energy Transmission Supply Fund set. And capital allocation initially of $150 million that was dedicated then to the development of the interior energy project, which was the description in general for the development of this gas utility within the interior. It itself became, with entities that acquisition of Pentex and merging that with existing operations, created the interior gas utility. So their operations basically are looking at development of LNG, through the Titan LNG facilities in Port McKenzie, transporting that up to a tank system that they built within Fairbanks North Star Borough, and then supplying LNG and gas connections to the community. North Pole is absolutely one of the areas connected. They most recently completed the tank system last year for the community itself. We have quarterly reports ultimately on the status of our loans to the interior gas utility. That was about $139 million outstanding at this point under a specific structure that was designated by Senate Bill 23 and House Bill 105. And so we monitor and report on ultimately how they're advancing connections and based upon their projections within those reports. What I would highlight is connecting, if we are able to do 150 units, connecting 150 units for IGU would be a significant progress for that development. But Angela, if I could ask you to please give a little background for our board, and Bill, if you would also come up, because you've been actively involved on that, with the land, how that was identified, and the availability of connections and why we've been focusing on that land.
Yes, thank you. So the land is vacant, and it is in close proximity to the city of North Pole. And as such, it has access to municipal water and sewer. And as the slide indicates, part of our due diligence that we have been embarking upon and have some preliminary results indicates that those two are available and have capacity. So that covers both the gas, the water, and the sewer on the proximity of this property.
And then if you could also give a little bit of background of where we are, and on one of the subsequent slides we talked about, you know, timing that's in there. But with the current slide up here with the visual of the property, could you talk about what due diligence we're currently undertaking?
Yes. I just finished on a phone call with our environmental consultant summarizing the phase one that was completed, and we are in receipt of that report. And the indications are there's a known historic sulfalane and PFAS plume in the groundwater that does not extend into the above the water line. And secondly, there are some cars on the property, and there's unknown. There may have the potential to be some fluids associated with that, so a follow-up will be required when the snow melts to address that.
So that's the initial review, right? So we're actually, you know, following it up, making sure that this complies with what development we need to undertake for housing unit development. We've also engaged different consultants that have been on a sole source basis, and I want to identify the fact that we've undertaken that because of the expeditious need to engage contractors on the timing requirement to get the housing units in place, ultimately for the military availability by the summer of 2023. In doing that, what I would ask, if we could go to the next slide, please. We're talking about a timeline this year. There's quite a bit of work that's required for us to undertake during this current field season on the property to get the utility connections and, you know, preparation for road networks, everything else on whatever the final layout will be for the housing development, for then ultimately to have the land available for housing contractors and unit builders by the following field season. So that is our key target, is having this available by 2023. And that does mean that we need to initiate some contractors at this early phase to really do some of this initial studies. That includes the environmental review, which obviously is going to have a subsequent analysis attached with it, but also includes geotechnical work that needs to be undertaken at this point in time. It includes the surveying for the land itself. It also includes the layout designs, you know, effective design in this case, where you engage these contractors. The intent would be with the construction contract themselves that we would do that through a competitive bid process.
Mr. Chair, is the 36 acres privately held?
To the chair, board member Ellidge, yes, it is privately held. It's currently under a sales contract initiated by the city of North Pole. So the obligation would be for us to conclude this, and this is another element I'm glad you asked us, need to highlight, another element because of the expeditious need. We have 60 days to ultimately undertake our due diligence in this case. I'm sorry, I need to correct that. 70 days, I believe.
No.
90 days, excuse me. 90 days to undertake our due diligence, ultimately for, to also have the time process to go through the public procedure of the city of North Pole to have approval to acquire the land.
And the 90 days started March 21st.
Thank you, Alan.
Chairman,
Alan, thank you for the presentation. So these housing units, they're only going to be for military personnel, or will anyone be able to come and buy those properties?
So the housing units themselves are going to be broadly open to the public. So the development itself, in partnership with the City of North Pole, and I would highlight the Fairbanks North Star Borough, is a public, effectively a public use facility development for the purposes of the economic development benefits that come from off-base housing. However, it's not exclusive to the military. There are, the development is needed to ensure that there's a level of housing stock available for that expanding military mission. Thank you.
Hey, this is Julie. Again, you don't know how I feel about this, but I'm so excited about this project, and I'm hoping that this could be used sort of as a pilot and a model. Since I've taken this role on and I've been communicating with the other communities really throughout Alaska, I didn't realize that this was really a consistent need, mainly centered around, so as we try to chase down, how are we going to encourage the economy in Alaska? How are we going to encourage economic development? And we talk about employees and the lack of employees, and then you chase that detail down a little bit further, and, the number one barrier that the communities have about housing is that they don't feel like, or to the workforce is housing. And then when you chase that down a little bit further and you ask the communities why there's a shortage of housing in each of their communities, whether it's urban or rural, so it's interesting that this is a unified problem that's facing Alaska, but the issue that keeps coming up over and over, and just this week in the infrastructure symposium as we were sitting doing roundtables for the communities, what they were saying was it's this infrastructure piece that there's lack of financing for the infrastructure piece, and because of that, either the municipalities or privately held property continues to sit and is not being properly developed, though it's needed. So I love this project. And then the next question will be, hoping that we can use this as a successful model moving forward. But can you remind me, wasn't there a reason why this one was allowed, but it wouldn't be otherwise related to a statute in the military?
It's specifically through the chair, board member, Commissioner Sandy. Our ability to undertake this project is specifically related to the definition of a project, in this case, being within a military facility zone. And so under 4488.172, we can do public use facilities, but it has to be within the definition of a project for us. So that's why I was defining the Alaska Statute 4488.900, specifically 13I, which addresses the whole issue of a development that is within a military facility zone. That's what's enabling us to really undertake this structure, which we have leadership from our board chair in defining ways that ADIS patient capital can lower the overall cost of development for housing.
So knowing that and knowing how excited I am about this and how I'm crossing my fingers and hoping, and I met with the mayor from North Pole also and just thanked him, But I would really like to see moving forward if there's continued conversation about that statute and ways that this model, if successful, could be applied to other communities throughout Alaska.
Thank you, Julie. I do have one question on page 3. You don't mention the tax holiday.
That was not included in the summary, but it was certainly included in the memorandum that we had the initial proposal. So under the structure, the agreement had been that there would be some level of property tax abatement, and initially we had benchmarked that at 10 years. Subsequent to that initial approval for our due diligence, the Fairbanks North Star Borough has adopted a resolution establishing a property tax abatement for 10 years for unit developments that are above five combined units, forgetting the specific reference. But in our case, it would ultimately cover, we would be included within their definition for the 10-year property tax abatement.
How about the City of North Pole?
City of North Pole automatically adopts resolutions adopted by the Fairbanks North Star Borough, so it would be effective within the City of North Pole. Okay. Now, with that distinction, Chair, if I may, one of the elements with the land we're talking about is that, and reason why Project Manager Angela Keyes identified it as adjacent to the City of North Pole is that it's not within the City of North Pole directly. It would need to be annexed, and part of our agreement would be that the property itself would need to be annexed by the City of North Pole.
All right, so I would like to request that you put that bullet point in the project structure, because I think it's really critical. You know, it's critical to when you make the statement that we're trying to make it affordable housing for the military or support personnel that they can afford, and it gives credit to the communities, whether it's this community or future community, that they're hand in hand involved and they want to see success and they're willing to do something like this for projects like this. So I think it's really critical, critical component and a unique component, especially when it's military support. So that's my ask.
Absolutely, sir. We'll add that. It's a critical point of what we're trying to identify. It's a partnership with the local community.
That's right. It shows, again, the goal here for everybody's private time for me is that it shows community support, it shows state support through ADA, and Alaska Housing Finance, and of course military support. So it's a win-win for everybody. Now I can take this time to thank both Alan and especially Bill for taking the ball and running with this 20,000 foot concept that maybe I should have taken that phone call.
I just want to thank Angela and Morgan and Alan for all the work over the last couple of months. It's been really been through numerous different properties and had lots of conversations. These guys are working their tail off to get to this point, to find a property that worked for us financially, that was contiguous to the cities or the military facilities owned and had the utilities available. And overall, this project is obviously extremely important to the interior. The Air Force is talking about shifting airmen, either non-concurrent travel or potentially unaccompanied travel, which is going to have a significant impact on the interior economy. So we appreciate the efforts that you guys have put in. So
what I would highlight is obviously we're still early stage on the platform itself, and there's quite a bit that needs to be worked on with the stakeholders about making sure that this is lowering the cost overall for the housing development and that it works with the economics for base allowances. There's several amount of discussion that really needs to follow up on that side, and then we need to get some very detailed information on budget information, and Board Member Biddlemore, you've been very helpful in guiding us on the point of making sure we get the right budget estimates in place for the utilities themselves. But then, so there will be much more that we'll be updating the board. What we felt it was needed at this point, given the initial presentation, that we give you at least the status of where we're at right now. What I'd like to go is to the last slide that we have, and this is slide 6, which really ultimately gets to the point of, and for the public, identifying why this is public interest, public purpose. The military within the state of Alaska represents roughly $2 billion of our GDP. Now, that's overall when you talk about the expenditures that they have in place within the state, the military personnel that they hire, their payment of goods and services within the state itself. That's what's included in that total number. One of the key drivers that's been identified with this is when the military does procurement in its different areas, its procurement is predominantly over 80% local. So its benefits ultimately to our local businesses. So this is a key benefit for ADA in the loan programs and the investments that we do across the state. When it comes down to the community and our partner in this, it's by having the personnel off base. They're in the communities. Their children are going through our schools. It's increasing the funding that's coming to our schools from their incorporation there. It's drawing other businesses, other goods and services to the local community through stores expansion or maybe a possibly bigger, you know, store developments that happen within the communities. There's a broad benefit that comes from the military across the state, but also their personnel living within our communities. And that's what's driving this particularly for Ada.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Angela, it's good to see you again. Alan and Angela, both great work. My question is about the 90-day due diligence. Do you believe that that's an adequate time for us to take care of the environmental level one, and if it needs to be more extensive?
Through the chair, I believe the most critical path will be the environmental, as well as the City of North Pole having two hearings for an ordinance to then complete that purchase, that there are four of those that exist between now and the June 17th close date. So I believe that is achievable.
All four gates?
Four of the City Council meetings, not including next Monday. So we're aiming for May. And the environmental was turned around very quickly for the phase one, and I just received essentially an estimate, both time and cost, for the phase two, and I think it will also be quick.
If I may, through the chair, Board Member Ellidge, what I highlight is that we have done, and I really want to identify specifically, we have done sole source arrangements on our procurement. Normally, if we had gone through an RFP process, it would be 3 months before we could engage somebody. So given the need for a quick turnaround because of the due diligence period we're under, the need that's here in order to engage development on that property for the housing units to be available by 2023, and the importance of that housing and capacity for the military mission here, we took that path. So we're really only able to say that we have initiated that environmental phase one because we retained someone directly on that. And then we're looking to work with them on the supplemental work that's needed. We're working with a surveyor on the same basis. We're looking for working with someone who's out, you know, laying out the design, the engineering design for the master planning and the units directly on that basis. We will go to competitive sourcing for the contractors in the case that would do the work for the utilities, you know, for the investment. Once we brought it back to the board and have made be able to make the full proposal on what investments required from ADA's side to complete the master planning.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
My final question, Mr. Chair, is are you also going to be speaking with, like, the Alaska Home Builders Association to get them abreast of this, to get them aware that this is coming?
So through the chair, Board Member Fogle, we're talking to a lot of different parties within the Fairbanks community. And one of the elements I want to identify, General Stewart is a group with the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. They already pulled together a lot of these components under their I believe it's called the Tiger Task Force, that has been ongoing on conversations within the community about the need for this development. Really, the last three or four years, they've been having those conversations. So they pulled a lot of these parties together. We happen to be particularly tomorrow speaking with the Associated General Contractors of Alaska. But we are on ongoing different meetings talking to components of the Home Builders Association. We will reach out directly to them.
I believe one of the contractors who's been very engaged is the president of the Aaron is the president of the Interior Alaska Home Builders Association. So he is at the table for all of those contractor direct engagements.
And if I may, the way that we've been describing the platform, Lisa, what we were talking about, is that it exists on four levels. You have the direct partnership that's with the community. That's the the public element of this public-private partnership. So making sure that there's co-investment that's happening between the community, existing the forms of the land and the property tax abatement, and then our contribution coming through with the utility development. So that's one level of the partnership. The second level is with the home builders themselves. If there's not one home builder that we're doing this for, it's for any party that is interested in developing on the platform we're providing. It's then also the association with the lenders in working with the construction finance that works with them. It works also with the takeout. And then it's also the engagement with the military, ensuring that whatever's putting in place really complies with what they're looking for so they can expand their mission within Alaska.
All right, next. Loan dashboard.
So after that, we have the this monthly reporting on the loan dashboard. So from that, you'll see what is our current balance, and we've been talking about $422 million being the balance level within the loan participation portfolio and inclusive of some of the power project loans, a balance really of about $2.8 million that exists within the total portfolio. What I would like to draw your attention to, though, which is something that needs broader identification because this becomes material in the way that we're reporting our full information, is that with the the delinquencies that are within the portfolio, you see that there's a concentration now that's coming with KeyBank. And this is something that's been ongoing, and we're looking to address really internally within our staff and how we're approaching our engagement with the KeyBank. KeyBank is not actively involved in the loan participation program, so these are existing loans. And at this point in time, I believe that there's four loans for a total of $5.3 million that are currently managed by KeyBank. Clearly, there is assistance that's needed on the way that they're being managed at this point in time. So what I have asked through and also with the support from Morgan is asking that Tiffany directly engage with KeyBank in the way that we can take over more of a direct relationship on these loans, that we can address the delinquencies that are happening within specifically that part of the portfolio. Did you want to, Tiffany, did you want to address anything particularly on that?
I think as Alan has spoken to, we have found with some of the lenders that have exited commercial originations in Alaska in large scale and have not used ADA in years, they're just servicing the existing loans they still have on the portfolio. Because they've exited the market almost entirely, it makes it very difficult for them when they have an unresponsive borrower, when the borrower's rule. So it's really ADA that's been taking the first and some of the only steps to manage it. So we're almost servicing this loan entirely ourselves. So we are reaching out and have done that to actively manage, reaching out to the borrowers because we do have, as Ellen was saying, a concentration there that we are looking at in our service agreements only kick in certain instances for punitive measures in the effect that they're originating new loans. If they're not originating new loans, then we're limited as to what we can do. But we are actively reaching out and managing these in many cases when the bank is not able to take it over or get a hold of the borrower.
So overall, it doesn't represent a significant portion of our portfolio. Probably a little over 1%, but it does represent a large amount of our time that's involved. And given that, the program itself is really structured to, and the costs that are attached to it really are structured and supported, that there's a lot of servicing that is engaged directly by the underlying originating bank, in this case would be KeyBank. And that's not happening. Their service center is located on the eastern coast of the U.S. and it's not really directed towards Alaskan borrowers. So we're looking to address that directly and just highlight from the standpoint is that is how closely we pay attention now to the delinquencies, the loan service portfolio performance. It does not represent default in this situation at all. It's just a matter of ensuring that the payments are being registered and being directed to the right place.
Correct, and that that there's active servicing of each loan on the portfolio.
So unless there's any other questions,
Mr. Chairman, Alan, you do a great job. One of the things that I'm concerned about is our pipeline of loans. Seems to be we're here in month 7 of our fiscal year, and we only have written about $14 million in loans. I'm just getting concerned that our pipeline might be shrinking, so we're not replacing the loans that we're paying off.
So it's a combination of a few things. What we heard earlier today, to talk about the pipeline itself with pre-flights existing at about $50 million. So in combination, that would really get to the number that we had identified budget-wise of $60 to $65 million. We're not in control of how quickly loans come to us. We are in control of how quickly we process those loans. And that's what I was trying to identify a little bit earlier, is that what you will see on the loan write-ups that are done internally by Tiffany and her staff, it says on there the number of days that they've taken to process. And that is actually under double digits, single-digit days. So when it comes within our control, we are quickly turning that around, and in the context of when it needs to come to the board, which is, it's not the majority of loans, but there are a few that do, we need to rely upon ultimately our board schedule to do that. So we are unfortunately dependent upon the underlying originating banks to provide and bring it to the point of a full information to us.
Certainly, I accept all those. I'm just wondering if there's something that we can't do that, you're already out in the community mm-hmm. promoting these types of programs to people, because not the average ordinary person who's going into a bank for a loan knows in Northrum or First National Bank or Key Bank is not going to lead with, hey, let's partner with ADA. So I'm wondering if we can do a better sales job of how good we are and stable. We could get more into the pipeline.
Through the chair, Board Member Fogel, the program is in place statutorily and regulatory to support the underlying financial institutions. So our first course of engagement is with the financial institutions. And on that note, what I would highlight is that we have asked Tiffany and her staff, but it's really predominantly Tiffany in the extent that when she is going to review a loan that has been applied for and is looking at ultimately inspecting different parts of the portfolio in the community, we have asked her to really sit down with the local banks within that specific community and bring them up to speed on the changes that have occurred. I think positive changes on the way that ADA has been addressing the loan participation program, to also broaden out participation within. You'll see within the data here that there is a concentration. We have Northrim and First National are large components of our portfolio, but it is broadly across 13 different financial institutions. We need more participation by them, so we are actively doing that side of it. When Curtis and myself are in the communities, we're talking to the Chamber of Commerce within my presentation for ADA, we always talk about the loan participation program, the number of loans that are currently within the community, the total dollar amount, the financial institutions are participating. So we try to identify that as a key program. And then one of the other elements when we're talking and making any presentation by ADA to parties like what we're identifying with AGC, we always identify loan participation program as one of those key programs within ADA that is available for any Alaskan business as they're looking at underwriting or seeking borrowing long-term fixed rate, if it is the case for their commercial real estate development or in some cases equipment.
Yeah, and just there's other opportunities out there for you besides going to the bank, maybe the economic development councils across the state, getting the word out that we have this program to offer. I think would be advantageous for us, because I don't know, we're going to end up with the balance of this year, but it doesn't look to be a very big year for us so far. So for writing more loans. So that just is a concern that I see. But in the grand scheme of things, we have other things to worry about, but this is just something that I see, have seen for 3 years, and I just want to make sure that we're continuing to keep that pipeline hot. Through the chair, I would say that we are on that context. The program remains very popular, which we know through the pre-flight discussions that are coming through. And I do think that it merits the large capital allocations and discussions that we've been talking about previously.
Could I add a few comments?
Great. Thank you for the comments, Representative Vogel. I would say so this calendar year, not fiscal year, but for the calendar year, it did start a little bit later than I anticipated. We are now getting many applications coming in, so you'll see a distinct increase in the next month's reports. These are 45 days old. And there were a lot of weather conditions across the state. We talked about in January, in the Valley and in the Southeast, which delayed a lot of loan officers sending those applications. And so we have had investment committee pretty much almost weekly for week upon weeks now getting those loans through. So you'll see that change coming up in the next few weeks. And I would say also one of the things that I also tried to reach out to, I've been reaching out to some of the smaller banks, discussing with them about the program, doing a presentation to some of their newer loan officers, but also spoke at the BIA Providers Conference last week. So it's in a panel. Morgan and I and SBDC were on there to discuss with mainly off road and rural people coming in, seeing how we could directly help them in those areas. And highlighted some of the things that we've done, like fuel farms and village stores and places for their USPS in those areas. So definitely trying to reach out and reach those other places other than the banks, really getting the borrowers educated on the program, and then excited to see as these new reports start coming in, so you'll see those increases. It was a slow start to the calendar year, but we're getting there.
That's what I want to hear, is that you're getting out there and talking about the program. Everything else is just, we can't control. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So if there's other questions then on the loan report, if we go to the board resolution report, this is giving an update, quarterly update, as the board has requested on the resolutions that have been passed and what their current status is as far as remaining funding. So if there's any questions on that, I will go on to the calendar report. So we provided the board the quarterly investment report that comes from our external advisor on the investment pools and return. So that's been provided separately. We have it available also within the executive director's office for review.
Colin, do we need to have a Colin come in and talk to us about, you know, the current economic conditions, you know, inflation, worldwide events and whatnot, and if there needs to be any readjustment in our portfolio or what we should do or shouldn't do?
I think through the board, we engage them as our external advisor on the way that we interact with asset managers for the external investments. We can certainly ask them to come in and give an update on what the current status is that they're seeing, different portfolios change or be adjusted based upon interest rate changes that are occurring.
Okay.
We have in general adjusted our investment policy that was earlier in the year. So that would be then the way that we engage with them for this next cycle of asset managers.
Well, things have changed pretty fast in the last 60 days, so I think it'd be great for the board to hear. Yeah. End of May?
They come annually following our year-end reports. That would be when the information is available as of June, but we can bring them in for the next board meeting.
Okay. I think that'd be good interest. We have time.
And then speaking of that, then that's the identifying the fact for yourselves and the public that the next board meeting is scheduled for May 25th.
Okay. Brings us to item number 8, board comments. Albert, we had some questions.
Alan, thank you for everything you did today and the information you gave us. I just
would like an update on the Amber Access Road summer work project for this coming season.
Certainly. I would ask Dave Hunt here, Chief Operating Officer, if he would join us. So I believe he has an update on the current status of the engagement of the Department of Justice and Department of Interior related to the record of decision. At this point in time, there has been no decision on that by the District Court of Alaska. So we've been operating and working in engagement with BLM and BLM with the underlying stakeholders in this case with the annual work plan that we had submitted. Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, we had submitted this annual work plan at the end of January?
It was in mid-February.
Mid-February. So that is progressing. And I would ask Dave if you could give then an update to the board and where we stand on that engagement with the BLM.
Sure. So we had a couple of moving pieces with the BLM per our programmatic agreement. Even though the BLM has written those two letters to, well, the BLM suspended the right-of-way on federal lands, and then we had the National Park Service. It did not suspend work, and since our work is still, as you know, preliminary design, there's a lot of non-intrusive work. There's surveying, fish studies, hydrology, et cetera. And so we've continued to do our planning. We have folks up in the NANA region doing workforce engagement and job fairs this week and next week, and we did get from the BLM dates now for review periods, so the annual field report comments just came out, which we had submitted that back at the end of last year. As you know, those review periods were extended. However, we did get those review comments, so we're actively working that, and we also have, like I said, the field reports. The field plan has been distributed. And so the BLM is working with us under the programmatic agreement. In addition, we're applying for our permits for the summer because we still have to apply for normal permits for state land. We're engaged with DOYON. We're engaged with NANA under existing permits and existing agreements that we have, and engaging in our logistics, our planning, and keeping moving. So we are still gearing up for a field season for 22.
When do you expect to have, you know, literally boots on the ground up there working?
We had targeted June 1st is when the snow gets cleared, and so we still have some of that as our target date. Okay. We're planning that in our logistics.
Thank you.
So a lot of it is in coordination with our partner for the final feasibility and permitting activities, which is Ambler Metals, in this case, under our development agreement. So all of that has been engaging with them on the annual work plan approvals that we received here through resolution with the board and what they received ultimately for their portion of the initial, what had been budgeted, about $30 million worth of work. So nothing has changed on that annual work plan. And it's really working through with, under the programmatic agreement, in the process in place with the Bureau of Land Management and comments coming back from different stakeholders, how that gets initiated.
Thank you.
Other comments from the board, from any of the board meeting? Commissioner Sandy is off the board, so she exited state for right.
Well, I'd like to thank Alan, the staff, welcome Megan, our new HR person to the team,
and thank you, thank all the, you know, the folks that behind you, you know, make these things happen for us.
Thank the board members. It's only 4 o'clock. I feel like it's beginning of the day almost,
and look forward to our May meeting. And if anything comes up, any questions, please feel free to get a hold of me. Have fun tomorrow in Fairbanks. I'll miss you by the day. With that, I'll take a motion.